special education, just get on board.
Welcome to another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Sponsored by the TBI, Survivors Network at tbisn.com.
All survivors, all the time. For automatic updates and everything brain injury.
Join now at tbisn.com.
The only all-survivor and family network in the world.
Hood, you don't need no fancy certification, just get on board.
Listen every night at 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern.
And select night to 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern.
Almost 60 shows monthly bringing you unique perspectives and journeys of real lives affected by brain injury.
Sharing their successes and failures, giving you new tools and strategies coping with the effects of brain injury.
And now it is time for another edition of the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Found at braininjuryradio.com.
And now it's time for another live episode on the Brain Injury Radio Network.
Hello there and happy hump day from somewhere in Middle America. This is your host, Kim Justice, on the Recovery Now installment of Brain Injury Radio. Now, I thought Craig was going to put the shorter version of our intro on, but if he did, I'm really wondering how long the long one is. Anyway, we all get by with a little help from our friends, and that's great. Welcome tonight, everybody. Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. I introduce topics and survivors share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers. I'm on every Wednesday night at this time, 7 o'clock Pacific, 10 o'clock Eastern, or 9 o'clock for those of us in Middle America. And you can access us if you'd like to call in and listen on your phone, or if you have any questions or comments after our interview, the number is 424-243-9540. Brain Injury Radio is on 7 nights a week, and all of these live shows are immediately archived for on-demand listening, so you never need to be alone in your recovery, as quite a few of us were and are around the world. And so feel free to go to the on-demand section at braininjuryradio.com, and there's hundreds of shows there to choose from and lots of different hosts, and I encourage you to do so. I'd like to thank my Recovery Now sponsor, Lash Publishing. Be sure to check them out at lapublishing.com. Back in April, so they're coming up on their year anniversary, they debuted the magazine Brain Injury Journey. And it's just a wonderful magazine for neuroprofessionals, survivors, and caregivers alike. Quite an extensive section for veterans. Thing from stories to tools of recovery, tip cards, and so much more. But in any case, in the magazine, if you go to, I put it in the chat, I'm sorry, if you go to lapublishing.com, look on your left, you'll see Brain Injury Journey. Click there, it will show you how to subscribe to the hard copy magazine if you'd like it sent to your home or office. But if you scroll down a little more, it says, click here for your free, can't beat the price, online version of the magazine. And it's just a wonderful tool. And, you know, with a price like free, if you don't want the hard copy, I encourage you to get hooked up with the magazine and also to let your doctors know about it, your neuroprofessionals, your psychiatrists, your internist, any doctor or practitioner that you go to. I would recommend, the price is very reasonable for them to have in their lobby, and they might learn something. Speaking of that, I'm really excited about my guest tonight. I'm sorry it's under the circumstances that we had to meet and around the circumstances, but when I started hearing her story, and most of you know that I went 17 years without ever having met another survivor, and I could walk and talk after my ruptured brain aneurysm, and they turned me loose out into the universe, and there was no handbook for me and no handbook for my parents. And so life was rather a mystery. I spent many years in denial and a lot of years feeling kind of hopeless and helpless, which is a harsh duality when you feel gratitude that you were given the gift of your life back, but your life isn't recognizable as you know it. And I thought I was the only one for all that time until I came here to Brain Injury Radio a couple of years ago, and every Wednesday night I've been hearing woefully the same story that our guest is going to tell you started in the 80s for her and the 90s for me, and now in 2014 I'm hearing the same thing week after week. And so not only the identification with many parts of her story was like looking in the mirror and brought tears to my eyes, but the fact that she is very knowledgeable, very credible, and is already just a wonderful person for awareness and advocacy. So my guest tonight is Dr. Maria Roma. I do this every time I do it. Romanus. I'll have her fix me. Dr. Maria knows firsthand what it means to live with a severe brain injury that occurred when she was 18. It took her 29 years to find out how to prevent her permanent cognitive impairments from causing disability in her professional and personal life. An 8-week program of intensive holistic cognitive rehabilitation trained her to become her own self-therapist. Now, with her brain under conscious control, she's thriving and functioning better than she was her whole adult life. Although she's still working full-time as a pathologist, her passion is brain injury. As medical director of Give Back, she educates survivors and families how to become their own self-therapists. She also educates physicians, thank you, about chronic TBI and advocates for every survivor to have access to expert cognitive rehabilitation. And I'm going to type in and tell you in just a moment about an article I'd like you to refer to. And I'm going to read you the top. A guest blog said, Dr. Maria wrote to MedPage, today in response, this is their words, today in response to our ongoing 10 questions series in which we ask physicians for their view on the state of medicine. We were so impressed that we are publishing her first person account of what it's like to live with chronic symptoms resulting from traumatic brain injury. And I'm going to type that in for you. And if you've ever had disappointment in the traditional medical model, I think you're really going to benefit in so many ways from hearing Dr. Maria. Dr. Maria, are you on the line with us?
Yes, I am. You hear
and
me?
And it's Romanus?
Romanus, yes. But
oh,
you know what?
Good. I can hear you fine.
Okay. So, yeah, for the purposes of this conversation, just call me Maria, please. So,
okay.
I mean, I'm not your doctor, and I'm a survivor like you and, you know, and our listeners, and I just prefer Maria is just easier.
That's great, but honey, I wish you were my doctor because you are a hell of a lot more insightful than any doctor I have ever had, I've got to tell you. Excuse my French after I read the 10 questions. I mean, first of all, I knew some things after I had the opportunity to talk to you, and then I was reading more about you, and then I was reading through this article, the blog that I just referred to, and my mouth was on the floor, and I was like, I would like to put her in my pocket. I've already got copies made. I'm going to be having my just regular annual physical in a couple of weeks, and there's a neurologist I saw one time, and I apologetically thought that was going to be a worthless cause and just didn't go back to him. And you refer to that, and I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but you refer to it in this article where you pass the basic touch your nose. You don't say that, but the basic neurological exam. That's why I went one time to the neurologist, because he gave me the drill that just about everybody had. And that was like 15 years down the road that I took it upon myself to, oh, it's a neurologist that handles these things? Okay, I think I'll go to one of those. And, you know, he was really as non-productive as any of the practitioners that I had seen, and I had a visiting neurosurgeon, so he was really only there for, well, to save my life. I don't minimize that. You know, he was good with the knife, I guess, as saved me. But, you know, I had, and I don't remember, but what, maybe three or four follow-up visits, and said the same thing, and I'm going to quote some things later, but your mother was told simply push her gently, and that is about the story of my life and my family's after my situation. So just to give a little bit of background, and then I want to spend time talking about give back for sure and your current and future endeavors. But for the audience sake who hasn't had the opportunity to know you at all before, do you maybe just want to start at the beginning and tell us a little bit about what happened? I told briefly just in the intro, but if you just tell us briefly what happened to you and how you became acquainted with the world of brain injury. Personally.
Okay, I was 18. It was 1984, and we were traveling with my mother and a family friend to another state for something that we were going to. And on the way home, I was driving, and the car started shimmying across the road, going back and forth, kind of like, I don't know what the word, but shimmying is kind of the word. It was kind of going back and forth, and all of a sudden went off the road, flipped over a few times, and landed on the interstate highway going the other direction. And unfortunately, our family friend was ejected from the car and died. But my mother and I were wearing belts. He was not. And she didn't get anything. I mean, she basically got a cut on her leg, but the car landed on my head. And so there was a fracture on the left side of my skull, left temporal, frontal temporal is the area. And immediately I was taken to the OR at the hospital, and they dug the pieces of bone out of my brain and you know, stop the bleeding. So after that, I was 3 days in a coma, and I don't remember anything for 7 days. So depending on what criteria you use, I had a severe injury, you know, at the low end of severe. So just the fact that I had surgery qualifies it as severe as well, not only the post-traumatic, but the coma. And but anyway, I've had a hard time saying that, okay, because people seem to talk to me. You know, I don't look like I had a severe injury, and I do not mean to minimize, you know, the situation of those whose, you know, injuries were far more severe than mine. So I think mine was, I guess, mildly severe compared to many others, and I don't want to negate, you know, their reality, okay?
Right. I want to ask you about that, though, about what you just said, only because, you know, I call myself an observing host. A lot of the other hosts came with more recent incidences of brain injury, and they were hooked up right away with therapy, and they have support groups in their area, and they knew a lot. And I knew nothing when I came here except how to talk. And
okay.
I was just wondering, I mean, you know, like even in my own case, the aneurysm ruptured. It was misdiagnosed for 24 hours, so it continued to bleed, and I vomited violently all night. By morning, I couldn't speak. Within a very short time, I couldn't comprehend. Then I was in a coma for 11 days. And during the course of that time, had the craniotomy. And I read in my medical report, I didn't know this, and nobody told, but it wasn't until I wrote my book, I was writing it at the end of 2011 to come out in 2012, that I first saw my medical report, and it indicated that while they were in there doing the clipping, they thought they had it done, and something else, like a, you know, a balloon with a leak, I guess, started spraying blood around in my brain, and so it wasn't even as quick and easy of a craniotomy when they're back just learning how to do that stuff, because there was a complication in there. Now, to me, I call that a severe brain injury or trauma, at the very least, severe trauma to my brain. But it was interesting when I first came here, and I want to ask you, because you are an expert, now we're trying to come together as a brain injury community. But when I first got here, because I was an acquired brain injury and not a TBI, some people thought I might not be a qualifier to be here. Now, that has since changed. It's been almost 2 years. But, you know, all I could say to them is, honey, if you don't think that was traumatic, I got a bulletin for you. But I guess I would have considered that, I would consider that a severe brain injury, and have some of all the things that you were talking about there, and still can't get validation from a doctor. And that's why I appreciate you coming on so much and sharing your story. And I didn't mean to interrupt you there, and I'm going to shut up and let you talk now and try to take you back to your train of thought, but just when you were saying that, yeah, obviously you and I both know, you know, that there's people who can't be on an interview. They don't look the way they used to. They don't talk the way they used to. And I would tend to minimize my situation because it's not as visual as somebody else's. But if you lived in my skin and you had my life before and were an quote-unquote ordinary person trying to live in my skin for a couple weeks, I think it would become painfully obvious to you that it was not, there was nothing normal or back to the old way. Now, luckily, and we're going to be talking about that in a while, you found something to bring you relief that I never have. So that's the good news and the message of hope for everybody listening tonight. But I did want to start out by saying that here's a doctor challenging the traditional medical model, which is something we've been all groomed to accept, and she hasn't. And for a doctor to come out and say that, Maria or not, is a very brave and honest approach, and I appreciate that, and I know the audience will too, because it's not often that you'll hear a doctor say that, but I suppose those are the doctors that haven't had the brain injury, right? Maybe you wouldn't be saying it either if you hadn't been through your own experience. I don't know.
Well, I think you brought up so many points, Kim. Okay. So I'm going to try to address them, you know, a little bit. I wrote some notes, and I'm going to try to address them one by one. As far as acquired brain injury versus traumatic brain injury, yes, I do think that there are some differences, but a lot of the permanent effects are very similar, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because what happens is the brain is interconnected. All the different areas of the brain are connected with one another, and whether it's an acquired brain injury or traumatic brain injury, there are interruptions in those networks, okay? And that is why, you know, a year, you know, months or a year after the injury, your deficits or the problems that you describe are so very much similar to mine, okay,
mm-hmm.
and to others. You know, maybe the focal, because we have to think about the focal deficits and the focal injury and then the diffuse injury. And the focal injury, depending on where the brain is hit, or for you, what area the brain suffered from having blood spilled into it or not having enough oxygen, those will determine kind of the focal deficits. But as far as, you know, everyday functioning beyond that, the organization, the attention, the memory, a lot of
mm-hmm.
a lot of the you know, symptoms that you and I and most brain injury survivors have are to varying degrees similar, okay? And
yes.
So we do need to be talking to one another and esteeming one another and giving and learning from one another. And that is part of what Give Back is all about. Now, as far as the traditional medical model, the problem is, you know, basically in terms of medical history, traumatic brain injury is fairly new, okay? And it really
mm-hmm.
has come about with modern warfare and with high-speed crashes, okay? Not saying
mm-hmm.
that no one ever had a severe brain injury before that, but usually they died, okay?
Right.
So if someone had a severe injury, you know, besides Phineas Gage, which we always hear about, okay?
Yes.
Okay, you know, most people did not survive their injuries. Well, the thing that
right.
changed in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s when I had my injury is that people did survive. And it was so hard just by looking at them, especially if someone walked and talked fine, to conceive that this person was going to have trouble in life, okay?
Right.
And they
don't believe you.
Yeah, exactly. And I can tell you, I did 4 years MD and 4 years PhD, okay, combined program, and I looked at my medical books that I graduated from medical school with, and now I did not have a neurology textbook, but I had a neurology handbook. I had a neurosurgery handbook, and I didn't have the full neurosurgery textbook, but the books that I had that I studied from and that I took boards, you know,
right.
had like four pages between all of the books I had on brain injury.
Okay. Do you know if that is much different now?
Well, actually, I heard a talk by Dr. Brent Mazel, and Brent Mazel is a neurologist now. He runs a rehabilitation center in Texas. I've forgotten where. I think Houston. But anyway, he is the medical director for the Brain Injury Association of America now, and I heard him talk here in Kansas City in October, and he said that he learned nothing about brain injury, about the chronic effects of brain injury.
God.
And about the acute the acute things and how to handle a subdural hematoma, subarachnoid hemorrhage, you know, how to, you know, intracranial pressure. You know, you learn about the management to keep the person alive, to
right.
put a Band-Aid really on the wound,
yes.
and to get the hole healed and to, you know, to cover the hole and, you know, basically patch it up, okay? But as far as the functioning of the person, nothing, okay? And so he said that he learned, you know, pretty much everything on his own and on his own interest. And he has two sons who have since, I mean, fairly recently graduated from med school. And he said the only thing they knew about brain injury was what they learned at the kitchen table.
Wow.
So it hasn't. Now, it has not changed much. Okay, it has not changed much. And the problem is, it is not chronic brain injury. And I'm talking about, you know, after the person goes home. Okay, that's what I'm going to call chronic brain injury, okay? After
mm-hmm.
the person goes home, okay, and has received, you know, these days, basic rehab services to get, you know, get them during their doing their activities of daily living. Beyond that, first of all, insurance companies are not required by the government to provide any rehabilitation beyond getting the person home and doing activities of daily living.
Right,
okay?
And they didn't for me.
Okay.
Doesn't sound like
the
they're doing much of that for anyone else either. So, okay,
yeah.
that explains
then,
it.
Okay, and then I like to draw a triangle, so I'd like you to kind of visualize a triangle. And along the sides of the triangle, I write neurology, I write psychiatry, and I write rehab, okay? So those are the three areas of medicine that, you know, that should know the most about traumatic brain injury, and they do know about traumatic brain injury. But with the neurology, they basically know how to make a diagnosis. Okay, some of them do. Okay.
Yeah.
If you have focal neurological findings, and these days, hopefully, you know, neurologists can, you know, should know now that if you've lost any, you know, if you've had any change in consciousness at all, that you've had at least a mild injury, okay? And
right.
so, you know, I think most neurologists could be able to say, yes, you've had a brain injury, okay? But they would not necessarily know what to tell you to do about it, okay?
Right.
And then it's like with rehab physicians, again, the rehab physicians, their specialty is called physical medicine and rehabilitation, okay? So basically their focus is on getting people home. Okay, and, you know, I am now a member of the American College of Rehab Medicine, and not because I am a rehab physician, you know, just because of my personal interest, and
right.
I am getting the journal for the American College of Rehab, the Archives of Physical Medicine and Rehabilitation, and I tell you, every month that journal comes, and there's only one article in the journal that has anything to do with what we're talking about. Okay.
Mm.
And it's usually just, you know, it's just, you know, a very short, direct study, not really dealing with a person's functioning, like,
right.
you know, how, you know, a certain way to help people learn better, okay? You know, a very focused thing was the last article I saw. But again, you know, all of, you know, chronic traumatic brain injury, the focus of it in the traditional rehab medicine profession is very small, a very small focus, okay? Not saying that, you know, rehab physicians don't care about their patients, but they really, you know, they basically, you know, organize a team or refer people to a team of occupational therapists, you know, speech-language pathologists, you know, to
yep.
kind of to do the work of rehabilitation and to get the patient home. Okay.
Yep.
And then psychiatry, so we've had neurology, rehab, and now psychiatry. Psychiatry only ends up, you know, dealing with the brain injury, you know, with the survivors when they are anxious, when they are, you know, sometimes they become manic, they most often become depressed, okay, and basically
yep.
dealing with, you know, the side of the emotional overtones of the injury, but they're not dealing with how to get them to function better in everyday life. If they did, you know, perhaps the people would be less depressed. And I can tell you what, I feel like I'm a different person since I got the help that I needed, and we can talk about that more later. But but in the middle of this triangle, I draw a circle. Okay, there's a big hole in the middle of this triangle, and that's what I call the chronic traumatic brain injury. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You know, none of these medical specialties are equipped, okay, to really understand or to help people with chronic traumatic brain injury. Okay, some will refer people to neuropsychologists. But most neuropsychologists, and I don't know what the percentage is, but I think it's like 95% or more, 95% or more neuropsychologists, what they are equipped to do is to test and to find the deficit.
Exactly.
Okay? They're not actually doing the cognitive remediation work with the patients, okay? So that traditionally has gone to occupational therapists and speech-language pathologists. And, you know, I have met several, and I, you know, good friends with one, and they are good people, and they, you know, but they don't get very much time with their patients, okay? If they get to see a patient, you know, once a week for, you know, a handful of weeks, often that's about all they get, you know?
Right.
And
mm-hmm.
It's not, I can tell you that once a week, I did, you know, before I went and did this intensive program, I did a once a week program, you know, several months before with a speech-language pathologist, and she was the best person in town, and she did help me understand more what was going on with me, and I did become more efficient when I was using the strategies she talked about. But what I needed was training, and that's what the program that I did, you know, it was like boot camp. It trained me how to run my brain better. So, okay, so now this whole of chronic TBI, that is, you know, That is where we need to bring the standard of practice up, okay? First of all, we need to educate physicians how to diagnose, and I really deal with that in that article. And if you don't, you know, if you want to ever look up the article, just, you know, put in MedPage, Google MedPage and Romanas spelled with A-S at the end, Roman as,
mm-hmm.
and you can pull it up.
And I did, excuse me, Maria, I did put it in the chat room, too, for those of you that are looking. So all one word, lowercase, medpagetoday.com.
Okay.
Go ahead.
I went to a doctor, so going back to my injury, okay, so I was discharged 2.5 weeks later after my injury. We were in another state. The only follow-up I was on the plastic surgery service by the time I was discharged because they had to use a graft from my leg to cover the hole. Okay, it was too big, I guess, for a plate, and they couldn't pull the skin back over it because there was too much skin that was destroyed. And so the only follow-up that was arranged was with a plastic surgeon. Okay, I never saw, I don't even remember seeing a neurosurgeon ever. Okay. You know, my mother obviously was, you know, interacting with them, but I don't remember, you know. I just had kind of a flashback of someone pulling off the bandages or something. Oh, man, that's
right.
Kind of weird. Okay,
yeah.
So, yeah, that's kind of weird. I haven't thought about that. Okay, but, yeah, I was not, basically I was sent home, and I slept a lot. Basically, I slept 16, 20 hours a day for a couple months. And I took frequent naps almost, you know, every day, you know, for pretty much for the next year. But after that, I thought it was fine. I thought, you know, basically I kind of thought of my brain that had gotten stunned or shocked,
mm-hmm.
you know, that sort of idea. Because no one ever said you have a brain injury. I knew I had
no.
a skull fracture. So basically I went on to college. I did... Well, I got a 4.0 in chemistry, but it wasn't, I had my glitches along the way. You know, I wasn't a perfect student, and there were, you know, times I did poorly on an exam, and if it was, it was always the first one, okay? And, you know, it was like I had to, but by the end of the class, by the end of the semester, I would either score so high on the final, or they would throw out the lowest score. Well, somehow I always got my A. Okay. So it was kind of weird how that always happened. My friends would say, it's like you're blessed, you know. So, but yeah, it was a struggle, and but I didn't understand. I just thought it was my idiosyncrasy, you know. But the thing is, I would study harder. Okay, I studied more than any of my friends, but then I did better than most of my friends. Okay, and I didn't clue in to the fact that this had anything to do with my brain injury. And then I went on to, you know, medical school, and I don't really want to get into all the details, but there were things that started that were happening when I was a graduate student, where people would say, "That's really strange. You know, why does she have a problem with that? She's so smart. Why do you have a problem with that?" You know, and where I would do really well on written exams, but on an oral testing situation, I was floundering. I floundered. Okay, I would catch the first part of the question, and then just kind of, you know, start talking about it and then lose track and not ever, you know, get to the point or answer the question because I'd forgotten it. I'd forgotten the rest of the question. And so my PhD mentor said, "It's like you never heard the question," okay?
Yeah.
A couple of things when I did my, you know, just situational awareness, no understanding what was to be expected of me, it took me a lot longer to understand that when I was, you know, on a new medical service, like from OB to surgery to medicine. You know, you have one or two, you know, month rotations. And
right.
It always seemed to take a week to get to the point where I was feeling comfortable, okay? Where the other people were getting it, the other students that were along with me were getting it like in a day or two, okay? And I perceived that, but I thought it was, because I had done the PhD in the middle. I did 2 years of MD, then the PhD, and then 2 years of MD, okay, the last 2 years. So I thought it had to do with that.
Mm-hmm.
But finally, towards the end of med school, I asked a question at a lecture on seizures, okay? And after the lecture, I spoke to the neurologist, and I asked him, I said, you know, I had a brain injury 13 years ago, and I, you know, am I out of the range to consider developing seizures? And he said, "Let me send you a chapter. I'll send you something." And he sent me a chapter titled "The Long-Term Consequences of Head Injury," something like that. And as I was reading the article, I mean this chapter, I was like, "This is me." Okay, it was talking about amnestic anomia, like not being able to come up with the right word. Okay.
Yeah.
And anyone who knows me well knows that sometimes I mean, it happens to everybody, and that's what people say. Oh, that happens
mm-hmm.
to me all the time, okay?
Yep.
But I tell them, I said, you may have a few scratches on your CD.
Yeah.
I have thousands on mine, okay? So
mm-hmm.
multiply your all the time by at least 100, but more likely 1,000, and you'll know what it's like to live in my brain, okay? And I try to say it nicely, okay?
Right.
But they seem to get it then, okay? But so amnestic anomia was one where you can't come up with the right word, and especially for me, if I haven't used a specific medical term for, you know, a while, I have trouble coming up with it, okay? I'm a pathologist. I make diagnosis of cancer based on biopsies and you know, surgical specimens. You know, I tell people whether they're the lymph, what type of cancer it is, where it's coming from, if the lymph nodes are involved, if the margins are clean. You know, that's the kind of medicine I do, okay? And I forgot what the point I was trying to make. I can look at a cancer, okay? I can look at the microscope and be able to tell you all the diagnostic criteria for a certain entity, okay? Because not all cancers are the same. There are thousands of different kinds of cancers, really, okay?
Right.
We say lung cancer, but there's 100 different types of lung cancer, okay? So, you know, I may be able to tell you all the diagnostic criteria for something, but not be able to come up with the actual title of it, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So then I have to go to the book, you know, and find it because I know it is there, okay? I just have to find the right word, okay?
Right.
And so that's why I'm a pathologist, okay? I work at my microscope. You know, and, you know, with a resident, and I have my books lining the wall, and I can look up what I need in my books when I need to.
Now, tell a little bit about the shift, though, because originally you weren't in pathology, and that's not probably where your future is going to be. But just tell a little bit, back up one step, if you know what I'm talking about what you were doing and why you felt the need
to change.
Going
back to when I was reading that chapter, the amnesic anomia, something called circumlocution of speech, like being able to talk all around the subject rather than getting to the point, pathlessness, not understanding what you need to say or do in social situations, those are the three things that jumped out of me, at me, and they really didn't discuss, attention. I mean, it was fairly early article, but it was enough for me to understand, I think I have permanent brain injury. And so I told my family, my doctor, my friends, and no one believed me. How could you have done, how could you go through med school if you have a, permanent brain injury? And so the final month, my last month in medical school was on neurosurgery, and we were taking care of brain injury patients as part of, what we were doing.
Right.
It was mostly a nuisance because the neurosurgical residents wanted to be in the OR. The brain injured patients, they were monitoring the pressures and, keeping them alive and trying to preserve brain tissue. But really, they were seen as more of a nuisance on the service, actually, because they were more interested in removing tumors and repairing aneurysms, that sort of thing, that's a challenge for them. But anyway, I saw that these patients were being discharged to a specific rehab physician. And I made an appointment with that rehab physician, and he said, absolutely, there is no way you could have had the severity of injury you've had without having permanent cognitive deficits. And he said, with someone like you, it's not obvious, You don't have an obvious deficiency in IQ. But what's going to show in an unstressed situation, you may seem very much like your colleagues, But in a stress situation, like where you've lost a night of sleep, or you're hypoglycemic, you haven't eaten, or you go to a higher altitude, he said all of a sudden your performance will fall out with respect to your colleagues, And so he says, basically, he said you have less of a brain reserve, And then the other thing he said is that you can do the work. The problem is not your ability to function, but function per unit time, So you will always be slower. And maybe you will do the same work as your colleagues, but you will always be slower at that. Now, he did not explain to me anything about attention, about working memory, about executive dysfunction. He didn't talk to me anything about that. Those are the two things I learned from him. But he said to me, I said, what can be done? And he said, well, you've compensated so well, there's not much we can do for you, And basically, that was it. That's all I didn't see another rehab physician again for another, 8 years. And even when I saw her, she didn't say anything more. It was mostly for medical documentation with respect to one of my licenses I needed to get. And it was just I told her my story, and she wrote it down. She didn't tell me anything about how I could function better, So going back to what I intended to do, I had done my PhD, I did MD and PhD, it was a combined program, and the PhD research I did was with neurochemical mechanisms involved in different types of brain injury, stroke, seizures, and traumatic brain injury all basically set up some very similar common pathways. Neurochemical pathways that damage the brain, that extend damage into the brain. And that's what I was studying, the free radical mechanisms that are involved. And that sounds all very highfalutin, but at one point I was a free radical chemist, but now I can't say that. I have to go through my dissertation page by page to kind of remind myself of all that. But I'm proud of that research than anything I've ever done in my life. But anyway, whatever the case, I wanted to be a neurologist. And the reason why I wanted to be a neurologist was to help all those poor people with brain injury who did not escape as I did. Because in my mind, I had Okay, in my mind, I had escaped. I was not actually part of the, you know, brain injury community because I had escaped. Okay, so you know, I started, you know, learning basically during my internship that I, you know, basically I could not survive an internship that required working nights. I became very ill. I got boils all over my body twice. I got Bell's palsy twice. And when I things started spiraling for me emotionally, you know, it spiraled for me quickly. And by the time, by the time they let me quit, I was not even able to put together a shopping list.
Yeah.
It was just that bad. It was that bad. And I, you know, and I thought that I was completely washed out of medicine forever. And it wasn't until a couple years later that my husband wanted me to try again. And, you know, just for my peace of mind, you know, to give it another try, but in a residency that did not require working nights. And that was pathology. And so that's how I became a pathologist. You know, that first year, again, was difficult. On my first month in on the autopsy, my attending wrote in my evaluation, "Due to executive dysfunction, Dr. Romana suffered during her head injury. She can never hope to have a career in anatomic pathology." So, you know, wow. 5 years later, I'm doing autopsies. I'm performing autopsies on the table right beside his. Okay? We're doing them side by side. Okay? And so basically he ate his words. Okay? But, you know, right. And also like my first month on surgical pathology, at the end of the month, you know, the director said, "You know, Maria, you do good work, but you are so slow." Because I was so, you know, concerned about making a mistake, you know, that I was,
yes.
You know, and it was, I took longer than anybody else to what we call gross in my specimens, receive the specimens, find the part that's, you know, that's cancer, or, you know, document the margins, or, you know, you decide what pieces, you know, if it's a small biopsy, we look at the whole thing under the microscope. But if it's a big specimen, we have to choose what pieces of it we're going to look under the microscope that will tell us the story of what's going on. And so, you know, that process I was very slow in. And a couple times I spent 24 hours grossing, and no one ever did that. Okay, I set the record. But... you know, the fact is I did get through. And by the end, they actually, so that first month when he said that you were so slow, I told him then about my brain injury. And, you know, he got it. There had been another physician, an internal medicine physician, who had a stroke several years before. And during his recovery, he spent a year as an observer in pathology. And basically, Dr. Tofik got to know this other doctor well and understood, you know, that, I mean, this man ended up being an attending again in internal medicine and still practicing as far as I know, okay? But it took him time to get back to, you know, to be able to practice like he did before. And he is slower than everyone else. And there had been a surgeon who had fallen off of his house and hit his head. And he had to cut his surgical schedule to one-third of what it was before. It wasn't that he couldn't do the surgery. It was that he was slower at doing it, okay? And so, you know, they were patient with me, and I give, you know, my department a lot of credit for being patient with me and letting me, you know, fortunately I did not make mistakes. I did not allow myself to make mistakes, okay? I was very, very conscientious and double-checked everything, okay? And so I, you know, gained a reputation as being reliable, and by the end I was chosen to be the chief resident, and there was only one fellowship spot, and I got that fellowship spot. But again, you know, the transition, every time I go through a transition, it's difficult. So the finding of a job was difficult, and I was offered a job, and I had, you know, based on something that one of the licenses asked, I had to disclose my brain injury. You know, have you ever seen a psychiatrist in your life? Okay, I think that's an illegal question, but that was on the Arkansas medical application. The job I was going for was in Arkansas, and I even had to appear that before that medical board. Okay, and they said,
wow,
you know, you're fine. But in the process, my employer, you know, I had to disclose this to my employer because that medical license was delayed. And so, you know, 2 weeks later, he withdraws the contract. I mean, you know, basically, you know, he says, oh, we could not come to a conclusion on your contract. Okay, and so anyway, my department hired me half-time, and I had another half-time job at a research lab, a reference lab. I'm not going to say it. It's a nationwide lab. And, I had difficulty at the reference lab because they wanted 80 cases a day, and they didn't bother telling me that. Okay? They didn't bother telling me that they expected 80 cases a day. They were handing me like 25 or 30, and I was getting them done. But 3 weeks later, they were ready to fire me because I wasn't doing 80 cases a day. They said, we like you, you do good work, but you're not fast enough. And I was like, I can do this. And, you know, I did keep my job. And finally, when this position at the VA opened up, and they knew me, I had trained, done 9 months of my training at the VA opened up in 2000, you know, within a year of my work of, you know, it was within my first year of working. 8 months after I started working, I got on at the VA, and I've been there for 7 years now. So, but again, the transition from being a resident, a student, okay, a college student to a medical student to a resident, an attending, each level requires more and more executive functioning. And so each level showed my deficits more and more, okay?
Yeah.
And that's why I started running into trouble, okay? The first 3 years on the job went relatively well. But, you know, then I forgot to tell you, I had three sons during my 8 years in the MD-PhD program. I had three
kids. Good Lord. Didn't have enough to do, did you?
So,
speaking of transitions.
Yeah. So I'm going way too much into the story. I'm sorry. But basically,
no, you're not, because keep going, because I do want to drop back, and we're going to get to the give back and move up to current, but there are a couple things. Go ahead and keep talking. There's a couple notes I've taken. I just want to go back and ask you about things you said, but go right ahead.
Oh, we can stop now if you want. Let's do that. Take a little bit of break from the story.
Okay.
Well, one thing
I wanted to know, and again, I don't want to personalize it except to say that obviously you're not terminally unique if I'm relating, and that means there's a lot of others that out there think they're terminally unique who aren't. So I just wanted to bear repeating, and because I never had these pieces of the puzzle before, in fact, I'm taking higher exec function. Because what happened to me is I went back to work, but I was working mostly part-time hours because I was in a position where I could come and go, so self-employed, working on commission. So if I needed those daily naps, which I did for a few years, you know, or was having a emotional health day or whatever you want to call it, or I have a lot of neuropathy pain, physical pain every day of my life. I wake up and pain, so I'm slow getting started in the morning. But when I was forced to, 10 years out, I mean, I had been doing this dance with my old career, but then I needed to go into a full-time position that I would have been able to do before. But what was happening is, just like in your industry now, you know, with all the Obamacare and changing in healthcare, I was in the field of financial services, and right about the time the banks and the investment companies were getting banged with compliance, that's when I started spinning out. And see, I thought I was normal. I was hired to be an executive. I was going to do this. But every other month, and this is just what a point you brought up I want to re-accentuate to the audience, is that if I heard you correctly, like with me, my mind wasn't processing that this was too hard for me, and maybe I didn't want to go down, or like you said, the brain doesn't recognize it itself. But I mean, and you can re-explain that part, but I mean, about a year after I did it, and the only reason I made it a year is because they didn't know what my job was. A bank didn't have an investment department, so they hired me. So they were clueless about my job is what let me go as long as I did without pressure. But when the pressure started coming, there was that transition you're talking about from 20-plus years in one place doing one thing to switching to a completely different environment, being completely differently treated, and then all the compliance coming 100 miles an hour. That 1 month I got pneumonia, I started getting the gastro problems, then migraines, then I had to get my gallbladder taken out, then I broke out in a horrendous case of shingles that went down my forehead, over
wow,
my eyelid, down the
brilliant.
Inside of my nose. And what's really bad about that is that my chronic pain and my surgery and everything was on the left side of my head, so that's what I wake up in pain with every day. But now I've got post-herpetic pain on the right side above my eyebrow from this case of shingles that just knocked me down. And so like every other month for about a year, I was getting physically sick. And I think what was happening to me is what you're describing, until the way I handled it is one day I was at the office, and by now I was a zombie. I was an exhausted, tapped out zombie. I got up and walked out of the office one day, and this doesn't mean much to a lot of people, but I was one of the most responsible people on earth. But I got up, I walked out of the office, and I never went back. I still haven't seen the people, had an exit interview, said goodbye, kissed my thank you, nada, nothing. Walked straight into a psychiatrist's office and said, I think I'm crazy. And that's why I understand that part of your triangle, because that was the only person who would validate me at all.
Yeah.
The first two didn't, but I was dying. A slow, painful death. And anyway, that's when I folded up shop and left, because there wasn't anybody. Like you said, all I knew is that I was just getting so sick. I didn't think I was going to be able to hang on much longer, honestly. And they kept treating the things I came in for, like they ripped my gallbladder out, you know, mm-hmm. and gave me that harsh drug, whatever it is, for start breaking out in those shingles again or have the post-herpetic pain. But, I mean, nobody gave me a clue that that's what it might be. Finally, my body just said, you have to stop or you're going to die. You lived an aneurysm, but you're going to die if you don't get up and walk out and never look back. And that was what I had to do. But anyway, this isn't about me, but it's just what you were describing is what I feel like was happening with me, but I didn't have the verbiage or the support or the knowledge to describe the way you just did what sounded like my story.
Yes. It's so eerily similar, isn't it?
Yes.
You know, so exactly. So when people with survivors do try to go back to their original professions, okay, they often encounter the same thing that you did, okay? The fact that what they used to do, they can still do. Most, I would say, I have not worked with that many survivors, but the neuropsychologist who trained me, you know, I'm a lot of what I say is basically what he taught me. So if you have a problem with what I say, you need to talk to Dr. Schutz, okay?
Okay.
But basically, it's not so much, I mean, a lot of therapists, OT, SLP, speech language pathologists, a lot of them talk about retraining skills, okay?
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much retraining skills. Most people can still do their jobs, okay? I'm not saying all survivors are in this category, but most survivors are. They, eventually, I'm not saying immediately after the injury, but within a year, they are, many are, you know, seem to be able to go back to work. They look like they should be able to go back to work. They can do each of the individual tasks, you know, but they cannot put it all together.
Why?
Or their attention or their memory problems, you know, they start to interfere. Basically, but the skills, the actual skills to type, for example, I'm drawing a blank,
my case, you know, the compliance changing. First of all, it's legalese, and I can't read like that any longer. I was a voracious reader who could read books. I really can't do that. I can't hold my focus and function, and my vision is worse than it is. So I can read, like I read your article just fine, and I can do that kind of thing. But you couple small print legalese that even ordinary people can't understand. You know, my industry was the same for so long. If it would have stayed that way, I could have done it. But when the changes started coming, just like they are with healthcare now, they're firing them at you like bullets. They're so fast, they whiz by your head. That's what was happening with compliance. And so more and more complicated, more and more changes that frankly didn't make logical sense to me. They weren't in the business, so it seemed like what they were doing was based on ignorance, for one thing, and I'm seeing that in your industry now. But I couldn't keep up. And my Nana had a saying, the faster I go, the behinder I get. And that's what was happening. Or I'm dancing as fast as I can. You've heard that before.
Increased effort, diminished rewards.
Yeah,
you know, you're constantly putting out more effort, and you get more and more, less and less back in terms of what you get done. You know, I forget the exact terminology, but you would work harder, and I would work harder and harder and harder, and I would get further and further and further behind because I would, you know. So that's, you know, we haven't gotten to that part of the story yet, but that's basically what started happening with. So what was the other thing you wanted to talk about?
Well, it was just a brief thing, and it might have just been your license. I had to have licensure too, but the other night we were talking about job applications in general, and I was saying that if a few things transpire where I have to go back into the workforce, that if they're going to force me there, I don't feel I should have to be compelled to tell them about my brain injury and just go out and play like I did before, that I can do this. And I don't feel like it would be so unfair because it's on the inverse. You know, I took a little bit of psychology when I was in college, although I was a business major, and I was saying the other night, you know, they do studies, you know, do attractive people over unattractive people, or people that are physically fit versus people that weigh 500 pounds. You know, the government spent $1 million on studies about employment. So you tell somebody that you got a brain injury and you're going to get a response like what you got. And I guess I just figure, now you have overcome that and dealt with it in a good way, and you told the truth you needed to in your situation, but I really wondered just about that question because I'm in a situation right now where that might come up for me, and I don't feel like, first of all, at age 55 and being out of the job market for about 8 years, I've already got strikes against me.
Exactly.
And if I tell the truth about the other, I ain't going to have a chance. So if I really get forced, now I'm married, so chances are I won't wind up homeless, but you wouldn't believe the amount of people that have wound up, well, you might, who have wound up homeless that we talked to on this show for some period of time, or they still are. And if I wasn't married, I would be in that position if my income was cut off and I had to go out and look for a job. And I said, I'm 55, I've been out of the market for 8 years, and I got a brain injury. Now, do I sound like an ideal candidate in a competitive market? Hell no, I wouldn't tell.
Yeah.
But,
and so Exactly. So, you know, I believe, I mean, I'm a Christian, and I believe, you know, God has had his hand on my life. And,
yes,
know, not saying that he makes things, you know, roses, okay, but I do believe, like, you know, my current employer, my boss, you know, knew me when I was a resident. You know, he was impressed with my attention to detail and getting things right and the determination to get things right. And that's why he wanted to hire me. He knew that I had a brain injury, but he didn't know, really understand all the, you know, the difference between being a resident and attending. A resident, you do all the work. You do all,
right.
all the gross work. You look at the slides, you write up the reports, and then you sign them out with the attending. And the attending, you know, basically, you know, I was a very good resident. I had a good eye, we call it, okay? I had a good eye, and I, you know, did good work. But I didn't have to sign the dotted line, okay? When
right.
you're the attending and you have to sign the dotted line, there's a different level of confidence that you need, okay? And one of the problems with executive dysfunction is your ability to make decisions, okay?
Right.
And that was one thing that my boss said, you know, to me, you know, shortly before I went to do this 8 weeks of rehab last year. He says, if only this thing will help you to make a decision faster, that is all you need, okay? And the things that were easy, I mean, if I got like 100 cases in a week, 95% of them, you know, 95 of them, would be cases that I could immediately, just, you know, with really one glance and a good, you know, a good close look, you know, it's a no-brainer. Basically, you know, a person at my level of training is not a problem. I mean, you know, where it's immediate recognition, you know, as a matter of looking at margins, you know, that sort of thing. Again, it's not a problem. But those five cases a week that were not straightforward, that you needed to do reading about, that you needed to develop what we call a differential. You know, it could be this or this or this or this, okay? And how we're going to determine that, we're going to order this antibody and this special stain and look at all the results and make a decision. I mean, you know, that sort of case, okay, like rashes. Rashes are not cancer or not, okay? Rashes,
right.
They gave you a little piece of, little tiny punch of skin, like 2 millimeters or 3 millimeters, and you're supposed to explain the rashes, you know, involving this whole person's body, okay? Rashes are really hard, okay? And to look at all the different, you know, what types of inflammatory cells are there? What is their pattern? What are the epidermal changes? Are there epidermal changes? Is there swelling? Is there, there's so many little pieces to put together, and those are the cases that by the time I would get done with the 95 that were easy, I didn't have any brain power left to deal with
yes.
those five. So then those five
yes.
would go to the next day, I would receive more cases, and those five would just continue to get older and older. You know?
Right.
And,
mm-hmm.
and so that's how I was running into trouble. Some of my reports, you know, not most of them, but some of my reports were going, you know, going too long. And the doctors are waiting for the reports to know how to take care of their patients. And it wasn't,
right.
you know. And so, and again, I started to spiral, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the thing is, it wasn't just my job. Because if it had just been my job, I could do it, okay? And our numbers were increasing, okay? And of course, everybody was working harder, okay?
Yep.
And I was working, you know, everybody was working longer hours. But for me, I was working even longer hours, which wasn't as big a deal. But what really kind of put me off the edge was emotional turmoil. And that was
yes.
raising up my relational problems with my sons at home.
Mm-hmm.
My sons were all going through their teenage years at the same time.
Good
okay.
God. Yep.
Okay, so they're all very intense, gifted young men, okay? But along with that giftedness comes drama, okay? Drama
of course.
And
puberty.
And, you know, they were not getting the attention the attention they needed from me, and so there was a relational disturbance and trouble, and you know,
sure.
we had to go to family therapy, we had to, you know, to you know, basically to navigate those teen years, you know, there was a lot of, I could not, you know, something would happen at home, and then the next day at work, I couldn't get off my mind. And that anxiety, that anxiety, that turmoil just, you know, made me work even more slowly, okay? And so then I would work even later, okay? And so then I started developing medical problems again, okay, kind of like what we were talking before.
Yes.
And I got
yes.
to the point in March last year, I got to the point saying, I'm not going to do this anymore. You know, I am just not going to do this anymore. And am I going to go to, you know, a reference lab, you know, and sign out 80 PAPs a day again? No, I did not go into medicine to sign out PAPs. Okay.
Right.
I mean, I do sign out PAPs as part of my job, but I'm not going to, you know, it's, to me, that's mindless work. You know, I enjoy my job because it's intellectually challenging. And I, you know, love teaching the residents, okay? But if I got in a situation where all I was pushing glass slides, you know, a slide pusher, I'm not going to do it. I will do something else. And so that's when I called Dr. Schutz and said, okay, you know, I had read his book. I didn't think I was as bad off as the people that in his book. And he talked about, his book is called Dr. Larry Schutz, S-C-H-U-T-Z, and his book was Head Injury Recovery in Real Life. And that second chapter of the book explained the problem like nothing else had ever done. Okay, I read bits and pieces. I remember, you know, my boss saying to me about fatigue. I mean, he's saying, I don't understand why you can't just put the pedal to the metal and get your work done.
Oh, God.
Okay. And
I want to tell you just real quick, I have an acronym for that. You mentioned it earlier about one of the things, but an acronym I use on the show a lot is HALT. If I'm hungry, angry, lonely, tired, any one or combination, I fold like a house of cards when the pressure starts coming.
Exactly. And so, but you know, I didn't even know that fatigue was related to brain injury. Okay, I had to learn so much on my own. I remember him saying, you know, why can't you just push through? And I'm like, you know, I just can't. I don't know why, but I can't. And then I was like, you know, I wonder if fatigue is related to brain injury. Okay, this is just 5 years ago. I wonder if fatigue is related to brain injury. And then I started looking it up, and I was like, yeah, it is. Okay, and
folks,
then,
when she says, I'm sorry, folks, when she says 5 years ago, her brain injury happened in 84?
Four, yes, in 84.
Yeah. 84.
And so,
so
then
she's talking up to now. Okay, go on.
And then, you know, it was like, okay, so what is it? So, you know, is it working memory? Is it, you know, I started reading about these different cognitive problems, and I was like, well, you know, what can you do about them? And that's when I started reading about cognitive rehabilitation, but I didn't realize how bad my problems were, okay? Really until I went and worked with Dr. Schutz, and he basically put me through some, you know, really easy kind of tests. And it wasn't the standard neuropsych stuff. It was just ordinary kind of everyday things that, you know, that really showed up my deficits. I mean, ostensibly when you looked at the surface, oh, that's easy. And then I would mess up. And what did that mean, you know? And, you know, and I found that my deficits were a lot worse than I thought than they were, you know, than I knew they were. You know,
right.
The attention,
Maria?
Memory. Yeah, sorry.
Sorry, I put Larry's name in there. Can you tell me the name of his book again? I'm sorry, I'm typing it in the chat. I got his name, but not the book name.
Head Injury Recovery in Real Life.
Thanks. Okay, go on.
Now, the problem is it's you know, a limited kind of edition book, and if you can find it on Amazon, but it's like $40. But Plural Publishing, if you buy it in bulk of five, it's like $12 each. So I buy them in bulk, and I give them I give them to every doctor that I have, and then I give them, you know, to anybody who I think could benefit from it. But so that's how I do it with the I buy them in bulk, but you know, not everybody can do that. But that's what I'm just telling you. It's $40 for one book, but you can buy them in bulk through Plural Publishing for I think five books for $60, which ends up working to $12 each. So if you can, you know, band together with some other people, you know, you can get it less expensively. But in any case, that second chapter of the book explained the problem like nothing else ever did. Explain, you know, it's not skills. It's, you know, it's the ability to put them together, and that your brain has lost the ability, the executive dysfunction, that means that your brain has lost the ability to basically see itself, okay? It doesn't know how to, you run into your, you make mistakes, okay? And I'm not, you run into, your brain is not able to see all the little individual mistakes it's making. It does, and it doesn't know how to adapt, okay? So,
yes.
You know, we call brain injured moments, okay? That was one of,
yes.
one of the terms, okay? Brain injured moments, BIMS, okay?
I liked that when I read it. Perfect.
So brain injured moment, okay, like you know, and we could all relate to brain injured moments, okay? But what I needed to learn to do was to pay attention to the brain injured moment. Number one, not get upset about it, not beat myself up about it, okay? Not just shrug my shoulders and say, oh, well, okay? But to write it down, study it, and learn from it, okay? And that was the most important exercise in my recovery, was studying my brain injured moments, okay? And externalizing that process of, you know, like I said, the brain has lost its, the ability to see itself. So you have to externalize that process on paper, basically, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And make your brain think about itself and how it's functioning and how to make it better, okay? And that's how your brain starts to get insight and also to start anticipating, because you don't make this, you don't, the problem is it's so tricky is you don't make the mistakes in every situation. Okay, one day you can do it, but the next day you can't, right?
Right.
You know.
Exactly.
It's not, and it's situational. It's like when you're too tired, or
yes.
when you're too rushed, or when something else gets your attention, or you lose track of time. Okay, it's those kinds of, you need to, by writing down those brain injured moments and kind of analyzing what happened at the time, were you distracted? Were you, you know, somebody else was talking to you, you know, while you were doing this? Were you in a hurry? Okay. So learning the situations in which you're going to mess up and preparing
mm-hmm.
for those situations and learning to anticipate them. So when you learn to anticipate these the situations in which you will mess up, then you basically alert yourself to function better, okay? And
mm-hmm.
And part of, you know, part of the training was learning to do that. And I'll tell you what, I look at my brain injured moments that I wrote, and I've got the book in front of me right now. I wrote 135 of them during the 8 weeks. But and I'm still writing down. I'm still writing, maybe not writing every day, but when I have, you know, something that's, you know, I still write down the brain injury moment and say, okay, what happened, okay, and what can, you know, why did this happen, okay, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, how can I anticipate this happening again, and what can I do to prevent this, you know, this event from happening, okay?
Yeah.
And I'm telling myself every day, watch out. I mean, as I'm, you know, as even as I'm driving, watch out, pay attention. I mean, you know, you're going, you know, if I'm tired, I'm like, okay, I'm tired. I really need to, you know, sit up straight, you know, really pay, you know, just force myself to, but the thing is, it's like I have to tell myself consciously to do it, okay?
Yes.
Before, I would run into mistakes. Things would happen, and I would be basically surprised by them, okay? Oh,
right.
This happened. You know, surprised by these mistakes that would happen, I would feel out of control. I would say,
yes.
You know, beat myself up. How can I, you know, feel completely inadequate? I can't tell you, when I first started the program with Dr. Schutz, how many tears came, you know, just the sense of continually feeling inadequate, okay?
Oh,
because
I
didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand what I could do about it, you know. But now I do. Now I do. I know I have an approach for, you know, when something goes wrong, you know, treating it not as something, a stick to beat myself up with, okay, but treating it like a gold nugget, okay?
Right.
Okay, okay.
Mm-hmm.
You know, write it down, okay? and say, what can I learn from this? How can I prevent this from happening again? And developing a strategy to prevent it from happening again. And
you know,
And just I'm sorry.
I just, when you were talking, I thought of one, you know, when I'm trying to type something on the computer, like say book one of these shows and my husband comes home from work and starts talking to me, you know, all of a sudden I'll have gone from quiet where I can focus to when my husband comes in, the bird chirps, the four dogs are excited and start barking. He's like, how's your day? And a lot of times I'll snap. And it's caused a little grief, like, you know, what, did you get up on the wrong side of the bed? You know, and we were talking about those interpersonal clashes and relational difficulties and things like that you were talking about earlier. Now, I know that that's happened a lot of times, and so if I were to write that down in my mind like I just did when you were talking and mentioned it, you know, I guess my strategy would be to tell my husband ahead of time that you know, that I really seem to need quiet to be focused. And I'm sorry if I snap or do whatever, but chances are I need to either do that work at a different time, or maybe he needs to not take it personally and try to give me the time to at least finish my thought and close it out and come back to it later, but some kind of a solution where it's not a repetition of an interruption that is, you know, hi, honey, I'm home and just wanting to interrupt me for a couple of minutes, that interruption for a couple of minutes can make me lose a whole train of thought, you know?
Yeah. So, you know, we were just talking about this at my give back meeting the other night. You know, my husband, you know, like if I take my CD player downstairs and then I'm, you know, I'm in bed, I'm trying to plug the CD player right back into the wall, and then he'll start, like, you know, rubbing my neck or whatever, you know, husbands try to do. Okay. You know, and I snap. I mean, you know, I should be enjoying this, right? I should be enjoying my husband paying attention, okay? But he always seems to pick, you know, the moments when I am trying to focus on getting the plug into the wall, okay, or getting, you know, I mean, that sort of thing. It's like when I am trying to put attention on something and he does something that takes away from it, it's like the irritation just causes me to snap, okay? And this couple at the meeting, is the man in this case who has the acquired brain injury, and he's trying to cook. Okay, and she comes up behind him and tries to love on him, and he snaps, okay? And my explaining that story to her helped her to understand. For him, it takes his brain is working so hard to pull the attention together to do that task that when something takes it away, is the brain says, leave me alone, okay? I am trying to do this, okay? And my husband, you know, he's kind of learned, you know, like, John, at that moment, when I'm trying to, you know, when you see that I'm trying to focus to do something that's a little bit difficult, please, leave me alone right now.
I don't think they know that it isn't just a momentary interruption, but that you might have had a big momentum train of thought going that took you a long time to think of in the first place, and that in that split second, it can all be gone.
Attention, yes, exactly. Our ability to divide attention is greatly... Okay.
Thank you. Yeah, because you talked about the stick beating and all that. I have felt very bad about that. You know, why can't I be interrupted for a moment, be pleasant, and go back to my thought? Why is it such an angry thought, or whatever the word you used was? But it's because
irritated
and agitated for me, because I realize I won't be able to get it back, you know, or there's a good chance I might not be able to retrieve it, because that moment is just enough. It doesn't take much. In fact, on the show, people laugh that are my regulars because they'll hear me from time to time say, I'll be in the middle of a train of thought like this and we're talking and all of a sudden I go, something shiny, and it, like I've lost it. You know what I mean? Something in my peripheral.
Dr. Schuss calls that situational capture or environmental capture, okay?
Oh, okay, cool. I can say the proper words now instead of something shiny.
it's basically that. And so, you know, like when I'm doing my work, okay, mm-hmm. and I'm finding a little bit of, you know, difficulty in my task, it's so easy for me to go to do something like the shiny thing. Okay, I wonder if, you know, I wonder about this or I wonder about that. And yeah, you know, I really do have to keep myself from going off on tangents, okay?
What did you call the proper thing, situational?
Situational capture or environmental capture, okay? So mm-hmm. Another lady in the Give Back meeting was describing carrying shears across her house, okay? And she has the thought in her head, okay, I need not to drop these shears on the floor because she's got wooden floors, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, and then, you know, a bird chirps or something, and she looks off, and her hand opens. In that very moment, her hand opens, and the shears fall onto the wooden floor.
Yeah.
You know, it's that simple. It's that mm-hmm. simple. The attention, it's like we can only do one thing at a time. So that's another thing we need to learn to do is to discipline ourselves to put all of our attention to one task, put all of our attention to the next task, and don't try to do too much all at once, okay? To do, mm-hmm. you know, another thing that I tend to do is to put off the hard task, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm like, okay, I get, you know, these cases I can get, you know, done more quickly, you know, leave that hard case till the end. Well, then if you leave all the hard cases to the end, then you don't even want to, you know, it becomes such a huge hurdle. Your mind just doesn't want to overcome them. But if mm-hmm. I deal with the hard cases as they come up, you know, basically in order of the number, you know, the surgical
yes.
pathology for this, okay, I try now to do things in sequence, okay, and as mm-hmm. things come up, deal with them, okay, and, you know, at least take it to the next point, okay, take it as
right.
far as I can. Before I have mm-hmm. to, and then make notes to before, you know, so I can pick it up again. But yeah, because if I leave all the hurdles to the end of the day, then they're just not going to get done. So
yeah, and that's what I call that phenomena you were talking about, and I'm sure you have the proper thing for that. But see, I've done this all on my own, so I've made up my own term. I couldn't have explained these to a doctor before, and they might not understand them, but you do. I would coin that full basket syndrome, not the prioritizing, but the thing you were saying right before that, you know, something shiny is one of mine, sensory overload is one of them, full basket syndrome for sure
yeah.
is when those too many things come in. To be honest with you, I do it the opposite of you. I do the hard overwhelming one first, and sometimes I can't get those other simple ones done. I guess it's because I have the fear of the being overwhelmed that if I do the other things first, I won't do the hard one. So I try
yeah.
really hard to get the hard, insurmountable one done, and then I am just so exhausted and tapped, some of the other things just go by the wayside. And I don't know if any is better or worse, but it's just, you know, we compensate.
The one thing that Dr. Schuss taught me was to like when your brain is kind of fried on one task,
yes.
don't even try to do the similar task again. I mean, for a while.
Oh, okay.
Let your mind do something else. Okay, something that is engaging in basically a different part of your mind. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So to basically give those neurotransmitters basically, I mean, the easiest way to explain it is like those neurotransmitters that were needed for that particular task. Time to build up again, okay?
Right.
And, you know, so don't, you know, give yourself a break, okay? You know, you don't necessarily have to, you know, because when I had gone to Mayo, and I talk about going to Mayo in my story, but one of the things they told me to do is that you need to rest, like, every 2 hours, okay? And you need to rest before you feel tired, okay?
Uh-oh.
And then what started happening, it was actually bad advice. I mean, I hate to say Mayo gave me bad advice. It was good advice, I mean, in the fact that after I rested, I usually was able to deal with it. But rest, stopping to rest every 2 hours for 15 minutes was adding an hour to my day, okay?
Right.
And
yep.
What also, it was also teaching my brain a bad habit, that when something got difficult, I would say, okay, I need a rest. Okay, rather building up the power to jump, you know, that focusing and jumping the hurdle, okay? And I found,
right.
I mean, and that was something that he forced me to do in the program. He wouldn't, I remember the first day that I was in the program, I was going to, you know, take a rest. I was like, I just need to stop right now and take a rest. I thought he would understand because, you know, he's a professional. And he's
right.
like, nope, you're not going to be doing that while you're here. And I'm like, but how dare you? I remember so many times, especially during those first couple weeks, he would tell me something that seemed to fly in the face of all that I'd read or been told, okay, about brain injury.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, you know, I don't, you know, since I've come back, I have taken a rest, like during the day, I mean, we're actually lay down.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 times in the last, you know, 9 months. Okay.
Well,
before,
I find what
I was doing
it
several times a day. So
Right.
To get some
and I see what you mean about that, taking the more hours out of the day. The thing that I found that's a little more effective for me is kind of what you said about if I'm using this level of my brain, and this I just call distract and action opposite emotion. Like I take pictures as a hobby, and one year they laugh at me on here, the regulars, about the summer of the birdhouse. I had happened into a hobby store and found a bunch of unpainted wood carved birdhouses, and I can be a little compulsive or impulsive, and I bought like 10 of these houses were 99 cents, and then of course you had to buy a whole bunch of paint and a whole bunch of brushes, and I don't do things like that. But after thinking hard and getting mentally fatigued, instead of laying down, because a lot of times I'm too jazzed from the angst of struggling through that hard task that I'm exhausted, but not like lay down and nap exhausted, is I distract to something, like you said, that's using a different part of my brain. One summer I sat and painted birdhouses in between having to think hard, and other times I just got to get up and walk out, drive into the country, and take pictures. And those things help me. The only time they're that they cause a little grief is if you're at a family gathering or something, and you got to get up now and go take pictures. Not a good example, but you know what I mean. You just different kinds of breaks, you know, or rests aren't necessarily laying down and taking a nap, but or maybe just learning when to downshift, you know, when you're getting that emotional or intellectual fatigue, I guess. Maria, I know a lot of people are going to have questions, and I was
sure.
telling you an hour, but this has just been really fascinating for me. I want to talk about give back, and then we'll have let some folks come on and make questions or comments, but that's a little bit of the of Maria's history, both how she came acquainted personally with the TBI community and also the trials and tribulations just in the process of recovery, in the challenges of the medical model and trying to steer the waters yourself, what works, what doesn't, and about the employment. This is a great interview. If any of you came in late, I encourage you to go back and listen in the archive from the beginning. This is an interview that touches on a lot of different pieces of what we talk about on here, and I do want to say that we are going to be opening the lines here in just a few minutes. So the number is 424-243 9540. So if you're listening out there and you haven't been in the chat, I know we've been having trouble getting people. People have been having trouble as Blog Talk Radio is doing some technical changes getting into the chat room. So if you're just listening out there, do call in to 424-243-9540. And I'm going to give you a second number just in case you have trouble with that one. And I have that right here, 855-473-3711. And so go ahead and call in now if you like, and we'll just be talking a little while longer, but that'll give you a chance to try to get in on the line. So back to you, Maria. So tell us a little bit about... now where you've been working, but tell me a little bit about how you came to your idea about Give Back and what Give Back is, and tell us a little bit about that, what you're doing now,
and
your plans
back,
for the future.
Give Back wasn't my idea. Dr. Larry Sheets has been doing holistic cognitive rehabilitation for many years, and while he was in, I guess, I don't remember exactly when Give Back started, but probably about 10 years ago, some of the survivors that he worked with decided that they wanted to give back to the community because not every survivor gets the kind of cognitive rehabilitation they need. In fact, very few do, okay? And so they were, you know, basically they were asking, how can we, you know, help other survivors? And so that's how the Give Back idea started. And there's the original Give Back chapter was and still is in Orlando, Florida. The second Give Back chapter is in Los Angeles, Claremont, California, just outside of Los Angeles. And now we have a Give Back chapter in Kansas City. And Dr. Schutz is the executive director for Give Back, and now I'm the medical director. And what Give Back is, it provides education, okay? And, you know, I talked about his book, okay? And mm-hmm. and the book is good as far as, you know, explaining the story, I mean, explaining what's going on. But it's a little bit more, let's put this way, it's a little bit more technical language, and it's probably not the right thing for every survivor to read. I remember having a hard time, I think, getting all the way through his book. It took me quite a few sittings to do it, okay, because it is, you know, kind of dense text, okay? But another thing about that book is it documents stories of survivors and how cognitive rehabilitation helped them, extraordinary recoveries, okay? And then at the very end it talks about why do some people have exceptional recoveries and some people do not? And what can we learn from these recoveries? So, reading that book is excellent. But what he did for Give Back is he wrote two manuals, okay? One is for survivors, and the name of the manual is called Self-Therapy for Traumatic Brain Injury, How to Prevent Brain-Injured Moments, Teaching Yourself to Prevent Brain-Injured Moments, okay? And mm-hmm. And the other manual is for family members on how to help your family member in their recovery, okay? Because too often, family members often, you know, in their desire to help, often end up obstructing the recovery by doing too much for the survivor, okay? And then
yes.
The survivor, maybe they need to do it at the beginning, but then the survivor, to a certain extent, kind of gets lazy, and I can relate to this too, because when I was in my down days, I let people after I resigned from the internship, my mother came and to take care of me, and then I needed that help with the kids and to do that was that okay. But, as I got on my feet, I had learned these bad habits of letting other people do for me, and that right now you'd be very surprised about that, and I wouldn't ever let that happen now. But, you know, it's very easy for the you know, when you experience a failure and defeat to become, you know, basically becomes like a psychopathology that, you know, where
yes.
the person didn't have, you know, psychological problems before, you know, they may start having psychological problems because of all the failure, because of all the, you know, and
yes.
it really, you know, sometimes makes the whole situation worse than it needs to be. But anyway,
can you
family members, so the one manual for survivors and the one manual for family members, and they can be downloaded for free,
okay.
Mm-hmm. from two websites. One is givebackorlando.com.
Givebackorlando.com. Okay.
And then the other one is givebackla.com, like LA, like Los Angeles. givebackla.com. And so on the LA site, both sites were, you know, set up by volunteers, so they don't look like the newest and the latest, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But the material is excellent, okay? The material is excellent. And if someone will, it's easier to read the manuals on the LA site, but you can download them, find the place to download them easier on the Orlando site. It depends if you want to read them or you want to download them. And they're 150-page manuals, each of them, something like 150 pages. And they are excellent. I mean, I've just now had my third Give Back meeting. And between the first and the second meeting, one guy wrote up 31 brain-injured moments. There's a form in there about, you know, how to recognize your brain-injured moments, what they look like, and then a log, you know, an analysis form where you write down your brain-injured moment. And it's basically like a menu, okay, where you – were you hurried? Were you hungry? Were you, I mean, that sort of thing. It kind of gives you like prompts as to figuring out what situation, you know, made this worse, okay? And then making a plan to get better. And one guy, just between the first and the second meeting, wrote up 31. I mean, he even shamed me. 31 brain injured moments, okay? And he did full analysis on four of them. And, you know, he said, I am not making these mistakes anymore, okay? And his wife has also been reading her manual, and she's like, oh, now I understand this and this and this, you know? And they're written basically in plain, ordinary language, okay? And they're very short, like each page is sort of like a standalone thing, okay? You can just read about one topic and digest it, you know, and kind of apply it before you go on. They're excellent manuals, okay? And so I would recommend, you know, for the survivors to download them or to read them and to start, and the most important thing they can do for themselves is to start writing down their brain-injured moments, okay? Looking at them, studying them, and making a plan to not let them happen again. And then if they happen again, study it again. Why did this happen again? What can I learn from this? You know, basically forcing your brain to go through that process, because in the normal person's brain, these sort of questions or analyses are done like automatically, okay? The brain-injured brain doesn't, okay? We have to basically, you know, make the process happen. With our conscious mind, you know, I like to say it's like my car does not, the automatic transmission is broken, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But with my conscious mind, I can change the gears. Okay?
Right.
The rear view mirror is broken, okay? But I can look around and be very careful when I change lanes, okay? Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's learning to run your brain more deliberately and carefully, okay? And one of the
focused
problems of brain-injured people is that
really.
we approach tasks too casually, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We don't plan ahead for them, okay? And when something goes wrong, we're surprised, we get upset, okay? But if we had planned for them appropriately, then, you know, we would not have made the mistakes. Now, you know, I'm not saying that everybody can become a doctor, okay? I'm not saying everybody can go back to their original job, okay? But I think by studying brain injury moments and writing them down, everyone can become function better than they are now, okay?
Yeah.
That is the hope, okay? You can improve. If I, after 29 years, can dramatically improve my level of functioning, so can you, okay? And so that's my plug for Give Back. Okay, it's free, and it talks about you know, if you don't have a, it's good to have a group of others. I mean, it's basically, you know, it's basically groups of survivors. If you want to run your own give back chapter, get together, you know, get a few survivors together, read through, you know, maybe, you know, assign some reading and, you know, maybe one page every week, okay?
Mm-hmm,
but, you know, discuss it, you know, and then bring in your brain injury moments, talk about them and see, you know, basically how, you know, get other people's suggestions as to how to, you know, and we learn from one another. And that's the idea, is a mutual self-help, that kind of thing. Where
right.
We're not, it's not like a support group where you're just telling each, I mean, telling stories is important. I'm not saying, I just spent a lot of this time telling my story, okay? I'm not saying that telling stories is not important. But too often we get lost in the story, okay? And
yes.
That's all that gets done. And the focus of give back, you know, when a new survivor comes in, we give them the honor of to listen to their story, okay? But then we get
yes.
to work, okay?
Yes.
Then we get to work and to the work of recovery, okay? And
right.
so...
Well, and that's why I call my show Recovery Now. You know, I do
yeah,
like
I saw
to
that. I saw that.
Allow
that
people
awareness.
To identify, you know, with others so they don't
yeah.
feel alone, because so many of us were bumbling around by ourselves and were clueless, that I do like the validation and identification through, you know, some recitation of the story and how you got there. People are interested in knowing that, but I don't like to dwell in the problem. I like to focus on the solutions. But,
you know, first you
kind of present the problem and give the validation and identification and then move into, you know, being solutions oriented. And I'm so glad that you're also, I make a joke, somewhere in Middle America. We're fairly close by. I would love to meet you in person sometime. And
right.
I think that, you know, this give back, I'm just real excited about it. I'm going to get the pamphlets tomorrow, and I'm going to take that with your article. And my poor doctors are going to have some, I'm going to say, man, if you got to do it on the John and you're 2 seconds between your 500 patients today, in between throwing pills at them for 15 minutes, do it. You know, it'll be worth the time to take a look
at
this.
Well, you know what? As far as the article, I would encourage every person to print out. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, because my article is so great, but it will help the doctors.
It is.
I mean,
yes.
The thing that people ask themselves as they're reading it: could I diagnose this woman? You know, I don't. You know, am I equipped to have diagnosed this woman? You know.
Right.
And I think that they will learn, you know, a little bit about what they don't know. And if they can learn what they don't know, then they will look to learn something from it. I'm also writing a book with Dr. Schutz. It's basically a primer for physicians, okay? And it's directed at residents and general practitioners, you know, basically the first-line people that people, you know, with brain injury see. That may, you know, often what they will say is, oh, you look fine. You need to get over it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's often those first-line people that really do not validate the survivors and just discourage them, or they don't even recognize the problem. I mean,
exactly.
They don't even recognize the problem. I don't know how many times I told someone, you know, when they talked about past medical history, I'll say I had a head injury, and, you know, blank. It didn't seem
yep.
like any... You know, I didn't think anything of it either. I just said I had a brain injury, period. I mean, I had a motor vehicle accident and a skull fracture is what I would say. Like, I didn't say I had a brain injury because I didn't know I had a brain injury, okay? But for so many years, no one even clued in. Nobody clued in. Like I said, I had to make my own diagnosis, and I had to find the help I needed, okay? And it shouldn't be that hard. It really shouldn't.
I typed it into the chat room again, and folks, for anybody who has questions about any of these things, I have typed them into the chat tonight. I encourage you to go and look at, and I did write them down here in the chat, give back, and that's just GIVEBACKLA.com. or givebackorlando.com. And if you have any questions at all, you can contact me. go to my inaflash.org website. There's a contact author. Send me an email, and I'll provide you with our show notes from the chat and my notes here. And if we need to talk to Maria, we will, to color in the blanks. But I'm going to go ahead and we've got a couple people on the board that want to ask questions or make comments, and I'm going to let them on because I know we all get tired and focused, but I've just really, really appreciated you being here tonight. It's been a real eye-opener for me. Just like I said, there was so much identification and validation for things that I felt myself and discouragement. You know, there have been years where I've been so desperate and upset that I've spent a lot of the year going to different doctors, and then by the end of the year I'm so discouraged it'll be years until I go back to another doctor, and I'll go try acupuncture, acupressure, cranial sacral work, you know, neurofeedback, you name it, I've tried it, and you know, I get a little relaxed for a couple days, but it doesn't change my state of being. You know, I'm still struggling with a lot of the same things 20 years later, if not worse, because, you know, I'm postmenopausal now. That didn't help. This happened when I was 35, and I was probably, my brain functioned like your normal menopausal, postmenopausal woman at 35. So now that I've actually gone through that, some things are even harder. You know, the memory feels even worse. And yeah. You know, some of those symptoms we were talking about are worse for me now, to be honest with you, than they were a decade ago.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, maybe hormonal changes or whatever, but that validation isn't there. And so when you did the triangle, and again, for those of you who might not have been here, I'm not going to go through the whole thing again, but she made a triangle, and on one side is neurology, which is basically the diagnosis, not really what to do after the diagnosis, rehab, physical medicine, and they basically patch you up and send you home, and it's a good thing, but not the whole nut that you're going to need to deal with what you're going to deal with in the future. And psychology, and a circle in the middle that's the void, where there's a lack of knowledge and help and resources for chronic traumatic brain injuries. And I got to tell you, you know, in my case, I got dumped in the psychology end, and I just surrendered there. And that's a sad place to be when you know that it was an organic basis, and you go, oh, fine, I'm crazy, then I'll park here. You're the only ones that will listen to me. You know, that's a sad state of affairs. And it was sad in 84, it was sad in 95, and it's sad in 2014. And so I really appreciate what it is that you're doing. I'm so glad I could have you on the show. This show does go all over the U.S., 32 countries, and it's archived for on-demand listening. I'm going to promote it a lot after the show, too, and I want to be involved in Give Back. And I'm going to, like I said, copy that. And when I let a caller on, I'm going to start copying your medpagetoday.com/neurology.headtrauma/44084 into the chat room again. And I encourage you to click on that, save that link, and copy that article and take it to every doctor you see the next year, and encourage them to read it. This isn't that long. Even they should be able to do that. I have a brain injury, and I was able to do it, and they're smart cookies. They ought to be able to cover 1, 2, 3, 4 pages. So, you know, if it's worth it, 4 pages for them to take a look at, and I think they're going to have their eyes open too. If nothing else, I hope they get a little insulted enough or put off enough to want to pursue it, you know what I mean? To look at that and go, well, now that's not the case. You know, maybe that every now and then, you know, if you challenge someone in a way like that, you know, they'll want to prove you wrong. And sometimes that's the way you get through to people. If they won't come up with that on their own, or they've had apathy, or they're just too dang busy, or the books, the textbooks don't think it's important enough to cover, and they're not listening to the patients because they're harried, you know, something like a four-page deal like that, they look at that and go, wow, you know, and again, I think
it's important to understand that it's not because they don't care. They just And this is a new area in medicine, and the understanding of it is really so recent. And even when I was reading things about brain injury 5 years ago versus now, there's a lot of learning about it. But the thing is, the problem is what gets into the I think that if people read the literature, the articles that are coming out, they can learn a lot more than what's in the medical textbooks is 17 years behind, you know.
Yes.
You know, even what language pathologists are learning and even what OTs are learning is about 17 years behind, okay, you know, what is possible. So, it's not that they don't want to, it's not that they don't, you know, they just don't know that they don't know. I think that's the important thing to say. You know, don't take an antagonistic view. This is a problem with the whole medical system in general.
Right.
Okay.
I got to tell you, though, I did take a little offense because the first relationship I burned right with my brain injury was my first husband, who I went back to work and I was putting him through medical school. And when I understood that I put him through medical school, lined up his rotations with all of my doctors, I realized I made a mistake getting married right after I had my brain injury. But I still, because this person wanted something more than I had ever wanted something, I put him through med school, and then I promptly got a divorce. And it was because we were never going to see eye to eye. I'm also a Christian and a very spiritual person, and through my journey, which is a different story, some things happened that gave me some insights, and they were calling patients exposure units, so they were teaching them corporate medicine. Now, I don't know how many pages that he had in his textbook, maybe his 1 to 4 pages on brain injury, but what they were more concerned about was bottom line and how many cattle you could shove through the door, call them an exposure unit, not a patient, and how many you can shove through the door in a daytime, and that is not quality care. And I realize they might be carrying...
Assembly line medicine.
Yes, and I was so offended at it, I put him through med school and left. My mom will never forgive me for that, but we were too different. After I had my brain injury, and first of all, when we got married, I didn't know if I was on foot or horseback, but through the process of putting him through med school and seeing what he was learning, he wasn't there for me, and I didn't. You know, he wasn't there for me at all. And what I saw that he was learning and what I was feeling and processing, it wasn't something I could handle. It just wasn't a situation I could handle. It was one of those transitions you're talking about. I had never been married before. I was 35 years old. I got married in back of a brain injury to somebody who was going to be absent for our relationship.
Yeah.
And then be in medicine, which I was extremely frustrated with, and he was going to be a little pimp for the that system. And I don't know, you know, I spent time, like I told you, 25 years being a financial consultant, and actuaries call people an exposure unit, not doctors, for God's sake. It was more than I could stand, but enough of me. I'm going to let somebody else on the line, Maria, and I'm just going to take him in order of who's been holding the longest. So area code 803, you're on the line.
I'm
with
still
Maria
laughing
Les Paul.
With what you just said. Hello, Maria. This is Les Paul.
Hello?
Morgan.
He's our Tuesday
Paul
host.
Morgan?
Yes.
Les Paul, like the guitar.
Oh, Les Paul. Okay, you're Les Paul. Okay. I think
yes.
you're...
Okay. I invented the electric guitar. No, I'm playing it. The real Les Paul invented it. I'm joking saying I'm a imitation. My mom named me after Les Paul, and my mother was from Missouri, so you're talking about Kansas City, and she went through Kansas City and sang in there and when she was a young lady. So she loved your area of the country. I've seen things that you posted on the Internet several times before. I'm glad you had her on, Kim. She's a wonderful guest. I had some questions. I'm trying to remember what they were because I was saying, keep on going. You're just what we truly need to do is have a virtual you that you could, like, ask a question wherever we're at in life and say, well, she did this, and you just say, what would you do? And all of a sudden your voice would pop up and say, right now I would say, go see your doctor, go see your physician, and believe in yourself. I'm serious.
Like Ginny in the bottle, but Maria in a bottle, that type of thing.
Yes, Maria in a bottle. That's a very good idea. I really enjoyed listening to you tonight because
you've
got so many positive and very good answers that I can't even remember my original question. Oh, gosh, what was it? I hate
you're
that.
You're supposed to take notes because you know how windy I am. You're supposed to take notes,
I'm looking
audience,
to see,
when you're out there.
See if I put them in the... One of them had to do with the VA. I remember saying it now. And I say this fairly frequently because in Augusta, Georgia, I live right next to Augusta, Georgia, in Aiken, South Carolina. We have two VA hospitals. We have one in Aiken, South Carolina. We have several medical facilities that work with veterans. And we also have, I wouldn't doubt we have no more than 15 hospitals in a very small area. It's a very large medical area, the Augusta, Georgia, CSRA, South Carolina.
I found your
area.
Question. Very good question.
Well,
do you remember it? I found
the
it.
The question was, I'm always saying, because I meet so many military survivors, and then I'm a civilian survivor, and I know several other civilian survivors that could learn from each other. And I've been trying to find a way to make it happen to get a meeting in the middle where they could work, because we've had people come from the Wounded Warrior Care Project to our North Augusta support group and our Augusta, Georgia support groups. And I know you were talking about a while ago, another thing is a lot of times people just want to come to a support group and talk. Well, at our local support group, we've had some wonderful meetings. We actually had the news media come to ours tonight and do a major report on getting some major things done. So we believe in doing what you were talking about instead of just saying, hey, everybody, I'm here again this week. Hey, I'm Les Paul. Hey, I'm John. Hey, I'm Susie. And then come back and do the same thing over. We're trying to advocate for people with disabilities and brain injuries and all kinds of things. But what do you think about what I'm saying? Is there something I'm missing? Because I've talked with a lot of people, and we've had some VA people come, and they still come. But then they drift off and say, well, I'm going on back to my troop unit almost. And
well,
it's
you know,
that. Yeah, go ahead.
It's the culture. And actually,
yes.
At the Brain Injury Association Missouri professional meeting in October, which is really my first brain injury meeting, because really I did not even consider myself part of this community because, first of all, I didn't have time. And number two, I didn't really understand how much I needed to be part of this community. But anyway, but first of all, as far as military people who've had brain injuries, they really, I mean, first of all, there's a culture, okay?
I know.
That they,
yes, I've seen it.
And they, basically, they've been, when you've been through war, okay, it's like you've got something that nobody else has ever been through, okay? And it's very hard for veterans to open up to civilians, okay? And that is, actually, I'm talking with...
And I've seen that, I have.
And they, right. and they basically, I mean, and also, you know, the, if they have PTSD on top of it, they really don't like crowds and other people, okay? And
mm-hmm.
they get,
mm-hmm.
you know, if they have that sort of thing as well. But, yes, it's very common that, you know, hurting veterans really avoid being around civilians, okay?
You know, I've had quite a few veterans on my shows, and the thing I'd like to see, and my husband is a 20-year retired Air Force, and I get that, and there's no comparison, but I did a show a couple weeks, and I called it combat fatigue, and it was really me, and I said, whether you've been on the battlefield across the world or in your own backyard, Dorothy, and I was talking about, you know, some parallels, so I understand there is a culture in people who have been in a literal war. There are some, you know, obviously some unique aspects. At the same time, it's kind of like we were talking earlier, in the early days, there was a real frat house mentality between TBI and ABI and brain tumors and all of that, and we consented that, you know, a lot of the residuals are similar, and I think that's true, you know, in the military as well. I'd like to see us working more hand in hand because, you know, we've had a unique battlefield experience too, a little different than theirs. You know, usually there's not weapons involved in ours, but anybody who's been through a brain injury and the frustration of going down this road has indeed been having a battle of their own, and for a very long time. So I do think there's a lot of things the groups can do to complement each other, and I'm a patriotic person, so I have a lot of veterans on my program, but a lot of times the things they're talking about are things civilian, you know, that apply to the civilian population as much as the veteran population. A couple of weeks ago, I had a guy on talking about the medicines, you know, and all the SSRIs and the veterans committing suicide and a more holistic approach instead of the pharmaceutical approach. Well, you know, that he was targeting at fellow veterans, and he was a veteran, but that is pervasive in our society right now. Whether you're a civilian or a veteran, is the pharma du jour that you see on the television commercial, you're going to see 8 out of 10 people in psych or rheumatology on, I said, I remember when it was Celexa, Lexapro, and now it's Cymbalta, Prestique, and then the next round of commercials are going to come on, and all of a sudden, those 15-minute doctors, I think the fastest growing segment of drug dealers in our population right now are some of those in the psychiatric field. They got 15 minutes, they're writing out a script for the drug du jour, and you're out the door. And that's not veteran unique. And I think it's a good point.
Can I share just a little more? The example I can give is because we're close to two VA hospitals, and we have University Hospital, and we have, it was called Medical College of Georgia, GHU is the new name, I can't even say what it stands for right now. It's a very large medical hospital in Augusta, Georgia. I was told recently that it actually, the Augusta, Georgia area ranks number 2 nationally in hospitals for military people. I didn't know that. And the one thing in our local support group, the one in Augusta especially, but the one in North Augusta, which is just right across the river, really about 10 miles apart, we have civilian survivors and wounded warriors come in, and some of them are saying, I wish I could meet some more civilians, and we've had some, and I do sometimes see the PTSD. I've seen people have it flare up while they're at the meetings, and I know that can be a concern, but the example I can give where it ties in with what Kim was just talking about, when I had my last brain aneurysm, I've had brain injury and brain aneurysm. I've had multiple of both. And I was actually treated at the between the VA hospital in Augusta, Georgia, because they were one of the few people, few places that could treat me. I had they did a brain, I'm trying to say what it's called, embolization procedure on my brain.
Okay, sure.
And it was brand new at the time. It had just arrived. It was brand spanking new. So the VA hospital worked on me, University Hospital, which is across the street, and one other hospital. I'm trying to say the other hospital's name. They're all within blocks of each other, these big hospitals. And the military people were, I saw soldiers all around me. I saw regular doctors, and I'm saying, wow, this is some, and I'm in extreme pain, I'm saying, but I've never seen something like this before. And when they would finish operating on me 8 hours at each day for 3 days to burn away this in my brain, you know who met with me? And they would hold on to my hands and say, oh, man, I understand. You're a miracle, they would say to me. And I would be in this huge room designed almost like a military bunker, not bunker, you know, hospital bed unit, and there's all these veterans around me. I felt like I was insane, but I could see it. I was hurting so bad. It was terrible. But they were all saying, buddy, we're here for you. We've heard your story. And they'd come over and pat me on the back, and they'd say, you're one of us. You might never have ever fought in a war, but you're one of us. You're a soldier.
Oh.
And that, I guess that's what brings that to me, because I felt like I was a soldier in a war with those guys. And they would hold my hand and say, you were a soldier in a war. You had a bomb inside of your head, and it blew up. And that's what one man said to me.
Wow.
And so when I left there, I left thinking there's got to be a way to somehow bridge the gap where the soldiers are coming home that are having suicidal tendencies, a lot of people coming home committing suicide. I've met with people who were near the point of having suicide in our local support group, and they said it saved their lives. And they did it by meeting with some civilians because they said they didn't feel right in the military kind of setting. At the same time, they don't feel right in the regular one, so they would meet with me in my office. And I guess I know I've said a lot, but I just see a lot of people like that. They feel like they're lost in the middle somewhere, and that's why I was saying that.
Yeah,
that's
true. You're absolutely true because there's this image. You know, that you've got to keep up as well, that you're strong and and it's embarrassing to have a psychological problem.
Exactly.
Sign
of weakness. Well, thanks, Les. I got one more caller, and I'll come back. I've kept her over 2 hours, and she's actually got a job
she's
got to get to in the morning, so I'm going to let on...
Actually, I'm not going to work tomorrow.
Oh, good. Well, I have attended.
It's a brain injury conference in town, so the professional meeting. So, the timing worked out well. So.
Well, actually, you'd probably be better off going to work. Conferences can get a little dry sometimes, but probably not this one.
But it's
probably
not a big deal if I don't show up on time. That's the point. So.
There you go. All right. Well, then, Les, I will come back to you, and I'm going to open up area code 202. Is this our friend Allie from D.C.?
It most certainly is. Good evening, everyone. How's it going?
Good. This is Maria.
Can you hear me?
Tonight.
Okay.
I can.
Wonderful. I had you on speaker, and then I'd taken you off so I could put my earbuds in, and I missed them temporarily. But I am so glad and honored to be here, Maria. You are such a rock star. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on our wonderful radio program. And, Kim, great interview as usual. And I just had such resonance with so much of what you said. Unfortunately, I kind of came in towards, I don't know, maybe two-thirds of your talk and overview of what else, I mean, excuse me, of what it is that you were sharing, and I will definitely go back to the on-demand listening to get the full cadre of it. But I'm really grateful for your presence here and for all the information that you've shared. I, too, have just returned from a brain injury conference. And it was so interesting. It was wonderfully inspiring and just chock full of great information, had an opportunity to network with some amazing people. However, because of the saturation aspect of things. New information can be messy on top of what could already be cognitively fatiguing prior to coming. I just feel like I'm waterlogged at the moment, but I wanted to make sure that I tuned in tonight to find out what was going to be discussed, and I'm so glad that I did because there's just such a wealth of information that you've shared. I am all about being solution-oriented, and I can't wait to check out this givebackorlando.com and the givebackla.com mm-hmm. website because I want to get involved. I'm very, very into being of service, in service for the greater good, and this is a wonderful opportunity to do just that with an amazing format that's already templated, so to speak, you know, and I don't know who the originator of it was. I heard you mention like a Dr. Shute. I didn't get all the particulars, but I'm definitely going to look into it more and find out perhaps how I can maybe consider getting a chapter started because I find that every group, every organization has its own culture. And unfortunately, even though I am a member of a number of support groups, both on the brain injury side and the mental health side, because I too, like Kim mentioned, went the way of receiving a psychiatric diagnosis. I'm a brain injury survivor 6 times over, most of which were all frontal lobe injuries, and then I also had temporal lobe dysregulation issues. So this is all executive functioning. I have been struggling my butt off, and I'm in my mid-40s now, and my first injury occurred when I was 3. So between 3 and 20, the last of which was from a motor vehicle accident, I sustained 6 injuries. That's a lot, and never got any type of interventional treatment mm-hmm. because I was one of those persons that fell through the crack because I didn't look like, sound like, walk like, talk like, to an extent that there was something catastrophically wrong. And it was presumed that, okay, well, you know, she'll kind of evolve out of this. I know she's kind of foggy right now and with the amnesia and the aphasia and the dyscalculia and just all sorts of cognitive impairments and having to learn a lot of things over again, losing my language skills and counting money, telling time, a lot of stuff I had to learn all over again. But this is all something that I had to basically navigate the waters of on my own because even though I had amazing parents, very well-educated parents, they missed it because I didn't look like one of those, I guess, classic acute injury cases. But as we all know, especially those of us who are working in the field, just having a mild traumatic brain injury doesn't mean that the effects are mild by any stretch of the imagination. And that's such a misnomer. And I'm a living testimony to how the system can be, especially the medical model system as compared and contrasted with that of a patient-centered or person-centered one, and I'm all about approach, and I am a huge fan of peer support, and this is exactly what this is that you're talking about, and I personally believe that there is a wealth of untapped information, knowledge, and potential that exists in that space, that magical space that is created when we open the doors, you know, for that infinite field of possibilities where we survivors live and have the ability to thrive. But for many of us, we're just trying to survive day to day because that's all we can manage. And I'm just excited about all that I've heard. I can't wait to look into it further. And I want to know from you, with regard to considering starting a chapter, and I don't know if I made the point, but what I'm noticing in a lot of groups is that story reigns supreme, and it just seems like so many people want to lean on that story, and I think that, again, there is a place for that. It's very important to have an opportunity to feel self-expressed. It's very important to feel validated, and it's very important to, from a cathartic standpoint, get it out. However, there needs to be so what's next now that that's out here?
Yeah, way to move forward.
Exactly. Where do you want to see your life? What kind of dreams and aspirations do you still hold for yourself? Mm-hmm. If you knew that things were possible beyond the today, the here and now, what do you want for your life? Let's create it right now. What does that look like? And this is one of the reasons I'm so just you know, stoked over what's possible with the model. So I thank you for bringing this to our attention and for sharing the resources through the websites that I've not yet checked out, but there clearly is just amazing stuff there.
Yeah, so that's the problem is that too often, because there isn't much hope offered, you know, that people become fatalistic and basically they start to wallow. And I've been there as well. And, you know, and eventually people, you know, I liked what you said. Are you there?
That was Allie. She's
okay.
Here.
Did you mute me? I was muted again.
So basically, I didn't know if I had been cut off. Okay. So basically, you know, I liked what Kim said about awareness. What was the second point? Awareness,
well,
acceptance. Awareness, acceptance, action,
adaptation.
Adaptation. There we go. Too many people get stuck at awareness and acceptance and stop there, okay? And they accept living with partial disability, okay? And they basically are like, mm-hmm. well, this is the way it is, okay? And I think what, mm-hmm. you know, the message of Give Back is you do not have to accept that. That impairments are to a certain extent permanent, okay? But disability mm-hmm. is negotiable, okay?
Right.
Living with disability is negotiable. If you, you know, buckle down and, I mean, it's not going to happen overnight, okay? But if you will practice the give back stuff, people can improve their functioning. I'm not saying that it's going to be like I did 5 hours a day, 4 days a week for 8 weeks. You're not going to get the same result, you know, exact results as I did, you know, with that sort mm-hmm. of training, you know. But, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. that's what I'm trying to help, you know, make available to everybody. Okay, that's like my ultimate goal.
Right.
But give back is the best way, you know, if you don't have any other access to services to help one another out. So.
And very often the services exist, but the model that you're speaking of, the give back model, isn't there. And what I have found is that there are a number of individuals and institutions, if you will. You know, there's almost like this institutionalized learned helplessness and, you know, storytelling. And if you rock the boat by attempting to interject this notion of let's look for the rainbow, you know, let's push beyond those, you know, seeming barriers and speak the thereafter, because there is something beyond this. I mean, these are clear barriers to full functioning. However, how hungry are you? I'm super duper hungry, but I'm noticing a lot of people are not. And in those circles where not everyone is that hungry and that curious about what else is possible, it's seen as an affront almost. And there is pushback. And I've experienced that. So that's why I was contemplating the possibility of just starting a chapter here in my area, because very often I'm seeing such an absence of this type of, I don't want to call it aggressive, but this type of possibility thinking, this type of delving in the solution and mining for gold, untapped resources and untapped gems that we don't even know what's down there, but I'll be damned if I'm not going to dig to figure it out.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of people who feel a bit offended because it flies in the face of their paradigm. It flies in the face of, well, that's not the kind of group that this is, and why are you trying to do so much? And it's very frustrating and very disappointing, but I want more for my life, and I know it's possible, and I'm going after it, and I feel like it would be an injustice to only revel in it and pursue it for myself. I really want the experience to be the same for other people. I want other people to have that experience, but so often there just isn't, again, an inroad to help people get there. A lot of people don't even have a clue, not only what it looks like, but they don't even know that it exists as a possibility.
Yes.
I knew it
exactly.
did. I knew it yeah. did. It makes sense to me. But without the formula, you know, it's a formulaic process, without the, again, the template, you know, without the model, of how other people are doing it, and it's been proven successful, and this is how, you know, one can replicate it in your town, then how can one do that if they themselves are living with brain injury and we get wrapped around axles so much that we end up getting our feet tangled in a ball of yarn and can't move beyond our intentions?
That's right.
And then we're exhausted, and then by the time we rest up, we forgot that this is something we wanted to do.
I can relate to that. One of the compensation strategies is taking running notes. Okay, I think that's one of the most important things is learning.
What is that?
Running notes is basically, you know, you can do it in the form of a notebook that you carry with you. But, like, the ideas that cross your mind that you want to follow up on at some point, or the promises that you make. You know, let's say, you know, my son asked me, will you make cookies? Okay, and I'll say yes. If I do not write it down with my, you know, with the way my memory works, okay, I am basically lying if I don't write it down and schedule it.
I have learned that
I need to write certain things down. And if I forget something, that's a brain-injured moment, and I'm like, okay, what did I do wrong? Oh, I didn't write it down, or I didn't schedule it, you know? And the thing is, you know,
that's
too
beautiful.
Often we're like, this is important, I won't forget. Well, over and over again. I mean, here I am on my husband's birthday, seriously, on my husband's birthday. Mm-hmm. And I know it's his birthday, and I'm planning on coming home early, you know, finishing something up and going home early. And then I chase the bright, shiny ball, okay? There's some project I get involved in, and it takes longer than I, you know, an email or something that, you know, probably about brain injury, okay, that I was, you know.
Sure.
And then an hour passes by, and it's like, oh, you know, and, you know, just it's that easy. It is that easy. So we've got to watch ourselves. We've got to, do whatever it needs to take. I have timers at work. I have timers, you know, a 5-minute timer and a 15-minute timer just to, you know, make sure that I'm making progress in what I'm, you know, that I've made some progress in the last 5 or 15 minutes. You know?
Right.
I live and breathe by timers too for the same reason. It's almost like a metronome. It helps me to pace myself, you know, and it's an external reminder of a gentle prodding to, okay, this is what we need to do, this is what we need to do, and beep, 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 okay, did you get it done? And even if I wasn't actively working towards it, by the time it beeps, it clues me back in that, oh, yeah, I was supposed to have been working on that. And I reset timers again and again and again, and sometimes people get frustrated, like, well, why on earth are you using it? But it definitely serves a purpose, and I love the concept of being able to capture, you know, this drilling down to investigate. It's almost like doing a situational autopsy, you know,
you
dissect it. Yeah,
exactly.
What went wrong? You know, I don't like calling things wrong or bad. But what was the missed opportunity? What could I have done differently to yield a different result? And that result being the desired result. And how can I sharpen the saw to better predict a favorable outcome next time? And that mindfulness piece is key. It's so key. And so I'm just feeling almost giddy with excitement about the possibilities because I'm feeling very aligned with this, and I'm very grateful.
That's how I felt too.
Thank you.
Good word.
Yeah, definitely.
Giddy. I felt that too when I was listening to her. You'll really like it listening from the beginning too. There's some really tangible, and the one thing that you said, and I liken it to like a 12-step program. What the word that you used, Allie, a template. You know, somebody that can give you some instruction and some tangible tools. I call them arrows in your quiver. But, you know, the things that Maria was talking about earlier about writing down the brain moments, not just general journaling like people do, but actually taking note of those brain moments and looking at them, evaluating them, and then thinking about strategies to either practice avoidance or just make some kind of an adjustment to make the situation better so you can practice some damage control and increase your skill set. And she actually gives the template for that. So I'm going to be really excited. I'd like to have you back when you and the doctor are ready to release your book and give you some... give you some promotion for the book when it's coming out too. And again, I'm going to be heavily promoting this show again after the show. I just think this is a must listen for everybody.
Yeah.
Just because of what I have heard, you know, as a host every Wednesday for the last 2 years, there's so much hopelessness out there and people chasing their tail or like the little hamster on the wheel, and this is something benign that isn't going to hurt you like an SSRI. It's not painful. It's practical and it makes sense. It makes common sense mm-hmm. when you think about it. And again, it's like that sometimes it's on in your own backyard, Dorothy. Some of us once have, you know, our bell has gotten rung. The whole point of it is we don't process or understand things in the way that we did before. And sometimes we're thinking we're very complicated people looking for a complicated solution and miss what's right in front of our eyes. As you were saying that, and it's don't take offense, but it was like, okay, now that is really practical and logical, and I could see where that practice as a template would be extremely helpful, because instead, you know, we in another place I frequent, they say the definition of insanity is doing the same behavior expecting different results. And what you're offering is a way to not do that in this venue, or to at least, again, practice damage control and increase the strength of the positive skill set and turn down the volume on repeated mistakes and that insanity. You know, if you call yourself trying to move forward, you can't think it. You have to take action. And that's what you're offering, and that's what I really appreciate as a tool of recovery, and pretty much what, you know, what my show is based on is to host someone like you. So again, I really appreciate you being here tonight.
Can I say this real quick?
Please.
Can I say this real quick before you cut me off the line, please? I just wanted to mention also what I really, really like about this whole formatted template and I guess presence of this give back community is that you're not just in the mind toiling away by yourself trying to come up with this next greatest mousetrap that works for yourself. You're actually with like-minded individuals in the community of persons who are rowing in the same direction. So you have greater propulsion. You know, the velocity is that much more increased as a result. And I'm talking infinitely so, exponentially so. Exponentially so. And so the thing is, that group accountability is huge. It creates its own momentum. It's almost like flying in an echelon. You know, why fly solo when you don't have to? Why not benefit from that lift that's created when flying in a particular formation that, because of physics, makes it so that you will definitely be able to create less drag, more lift, less fatigue on the own, you know, on the individual involved. So I can't wait. I just feel like one of those little matchbox cars where you're revving it back and forth, and the torque is being created, and it's just ready to go. So I'm really looking forward to learning more about it.
Okay.
Thanks for being
good.
Here.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Great. Allie, thanks for calling in, and I'll come back. Our most gracious guest has been here 2.5 hours, which is probably bad for her focus on the deal tomorrow, but good because my 3-hour show is almost over, so I appreciate that. But this has been really enlightening. Do you have any closing things that you would like to say, Maria, before
you know,
we let you go?
I would, would not mind doing some more education. I have several talks that I've prepared for Give Back. I'm looking at a list of them now. Attention, the Ten Commandments of Recovery, on memory, on response suppression, impulsivity, and response suppression. I mean, we could do. I mean, if I can't do every week, obviously, okay. But when you've got a slot to fill, think of me, and I've got a topic to fill it. Okay.
I actually, you know, what we can think about, I'm booked out a month, but, you know, we might think about, like, around the 1st of May-ish, because one thing I'd like to do, like I said, is really get this show and a lot of flyers out, and that would give, you know, about a month's time to be able to, you know, weave this in and out of the mini Facebook and LinkedIn pages and things to get people to read it, and then have you back like that first week in May-ish or whenever would work for you, last week in April or any time in May, from the first week on. I think it'd be great to have you come back and we can do those topics.
Yeah,
I'd love that.
It'd be focused on, you know, what is wrong, you know, how can we get better. It would be solution oriented and compensation strategies and how you can apply them. So
yes.
You know, I love to do teaching and I'd be happy to do it. I just can't be on 2.5 hours next time.
No,
I've
promise
next day,
you.
It's got to be an hour, an hour and a half. Okay.
Yep, I promise.
All right.
I promise it'll
anyway.
Be an hour and a half, and we definitely have a date, and I'll keep my word next time.
Okay.
That's
all
why
right.
I really want to make, not make, but I really want to encourage everybody to listen to this show, you know, over the next 30 days or so, and then I'll enforce that hour, hour and a half, and so people will have to be prepared when they come, you know, by listening to this and then listening carefully, and we'll keep the questions a little more brief, because I do, and they were mostly my questions, not my callers. There was just so much that you had to say, so I think that would be great. So let's stay in touch, look at your calendar and see what you got end of April, beginning of May, whenever you feel comfortable, and let's pick a topic and do it.
Okay, good. All right.
Okay. Great.
This is the beginning of a long and beautiful friendship.
It is, and I'm excited. And like I said, I'm excited. There's a proximity, and you can go ahead and hang up, but you might want to stay and listen. And I'll tell you something, just because you work at the VA, if you want to make a quick note, if you ever just, I'm going to play a song as your outro. I normally play it when my veteran guests are leaving, but. You work at the VA, and I'm going to play a song as your outro, but there's a video that goes with it, and if you go to YouTube at your leisure and you just search three words, Chris, C-H-R-I-S, space, Dukes, D as in dog, U-K-E-S, space, Heroes, H-E-R-O-E-S, Chris Dukes Heroes, a video is going to come up to this song, and I think in the job that you're in, you'll really appreciate seeing the video, but I'd like this to be a dedication to you in your outro for tonight, because you truly are a hero too. You know, there's a lot of us, and the reason I say it, I don't say it lightly, you've worked really hard, but there's a lot of us out here, like me, when I read that paperwork that I'm like, oh my God, this is my story, but a lot of this is my story, but I don't get the credibility that a doctor's going to get among doctors, and even you know, I've hired, we don't do it like that. We don't get paid. We're all volunteer hosts, but we have a new platform 2 hours earlier than us, and I've hired three doctors, two neuropsychologists, experience and a man who spent with 20 plus years experience, one of them doing a caretaker show who was a Vietnam vet, and one who was a TBI neuropsychologist doing children and adolescents, and a year and a half ago had a terrible accident himself, so the doctor became the patient. He's a brand new host. The other one's a brand new host. And then a 20-plus year ankle and foot surgeon who at age 54 got diagnosed with Parkinson's, and he does a show. He's still got his sense of humor. He's early in the disease, called Shaken Not Stirred. And so, you know, I'm really appreciative when we can get the doctors in here, because they're going to have more credibility in their peer group. They're going to take their licks, that's for sure, but they're not going to get ignored completely like so many of us as much of the time. So I appreciate you using your credentials and hard work to be devoted, you know, to the brain injury cause, because I felt like you. I didn't think I was part of this either for almost 20 years until I got a calling. And we won't talk about that. We'll talk about that another time. I got a calling to do this, and you've got a calling to do what you're doing, and I don't think it's an accident that you have your pedigree behind you. So, again, I want to thank you, and I want to dedicate to you. Check out the video later on, but I'm going to let you go. Have a great conference, and if you just listen on the way out, this is a song for you by one of my great many indie artists. Chris is in Albany, New York, Chris Dukes, and this song tonight is for you, all of our veterans, and the ones you work with specifically at your hospital. You might want to share this with some of them. And my guest tonight was Dr. Maria Romanos, and you can get any information you want from me after the show. Thank you, Maria, for being here, and I know tonight, for all of us that have listened, you're one of our heroes, so you have a great conference.
All right. Thank you very much. Bye, Kim. I enjoyed this. Okay.
Thank you. Good night.
Thank you.
Far from Afghanistan, on lonely nighttime watch, he hopes silence keeps hold. It's been crazy here. my heroes, model roles. You're my brothers and my sisters, standing up against the cold. My hero, and always know.
That was Chris Dukes with Heroes, and God bless our hero tonight. And my guest, Dr. Maria Romanis, PhD, and certainly a hero and a role model. And as usual, thank you to all of our veterans. So we've got... holy moly, macaroni. We only have just a few minutes left in the show, so I'm just going to unmute mics for the last couple of minutes. Les, Paul, you're on the air. And Allie, you're on the air. And I see Craig dropped in for last call. He doesn't have his hand up, but if he's making lewd noises, I'll mute him. Otherwise, I'll open him up. Let's hear you, Ludi, rock star. No, Batman.
Busy day. Yeah, did you see any of the pictures on my Facebook of the kids today?
I did. It was awesome.
And then so we have them. Yeah, let it turn right. Not huge.
I'll be looking forward to looking tonight. No, I've had a really busy day, too. I was telling Les I got 4 hours of sleep last night. He's had a day from HE double hockey picks and sticks, whatever that's called, and also Allie has been at a conference for several days, so we're all rode hard and put up wet. But
we're a rock and roll band times 10, all of us.
That's right.
Up till 4:30 this morning, getting stuff ready for the conference. Went to bed, got up at 7, and I just got home about 20 minutes ago.
Oh gosh.
And I spent the day with almost 600 young people, 14 to 21.
Wow. That would be sensory overload right there, boy. Phew. Full basket, sensory overload. Aren't you
it's so cool. We all had a really big day. It really is. That's great.
Yeah.
It was a good day. A tiring day, but good.
Well, that's
in
great.
The trenches.
Yeah, everybody in the trenches, but everybody working on something for brain injury awareness and advocacy today, you know, by taking part in, you know, or leading all four of us that are on the board, spend our day in some way, shape, or form doing some aspect of that today. So I think that's really good. And Craig, sometime when you're driving down the street, you'll have to listen to this particular interview. I'm going to be promoting this show a lot, and I think you, Les, Paul, and Allie would agree. You know, this is one I think I'll promote a lot after.
It was awesome. It really was.
After the show for people to hear, and then take her up on her offer and plan on having her back about every 8 weeks as long as she's got some good topics and tools and talks she's working on. I think that would be great.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so tomorrow I will have news. I'll share it next week on Monday, but our first student radio show will start next month on the third Saturday,
okay.
So that's exciting.
Yes.
Wow.
That is exciting. So we'll get a new Saturday host and bring in some of the younger people. That's fantastic.
So, and one of the young
one of their dreams is to get into media, and he's right now in still, he's what is he, about 19, so he's in a transition program, and then he can go to media school. What a great thing this would be for him, too.
Wow, that's fantastic. Well, I'm really glad to hear that, because we talked about that before, involving some of the younger people, so I'm happy about a Saturday night host, and I'm happy, I'll be anxious. What's his name, or her?
It's two. It's a pair. Ty and God for the life of me, I'm so tired. The other name eludes me. And
okay.
I have a class then Friday, and so I'll have the name of their show on Friday too.
Super duper. Well, that'll be great. I'll really be looking forward to hearing a new host and having a, you know, an outlet for some of the younger people. Obviously, any of these shows, everyone is welcome, safe, and invited. But it's nice, again, in that identification and validation that we have a young people's show as well.
I was just thinking it's amazing that all three of us talking right now had such an amazing day. I spent today with about 600 people, too. We were in Columbia, South Carolina at the ABLE conference, which is an independent living center, and it was amazing. It was really – the one I was telling you about that you were saying I could try to set up a camera, I don't think I would have been able to. It was so crowded. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
It was really amazing.
They take a little prep. Yeah, I'm prepping for an April thing at the conference, so it'll be a Monday night special, and I'm not quite sure who I'm going to have on. I got about 20 people that want to be on, so I'll pick two or three.
Okay.
There you go. The old multiple mic show. That'll be good. Well, that's nice. You've got guests stacked up like that. Next week, let's see. My guest is another doctor next week, Dr. Coberta, I think, and I'm sorry I don't have my note in front of me, but he does have a neuro rebalancing center and is going to be talking about brain mapping, neurofeedback, mm-hmm. and a lot of other tools that have the word neuro in them, exercises and tools of recovery. So that'll be next Wednesday. And the following Wednesday, Randy Mallory is going to be on. He's a survivor who's become Overcoming Adversity is the name of his book, but he's become a motivational speaker and big advocate in the brain injury world. And 4 weeks from now on Wednesday, Kim, of course I remember that part of her name, and I'll let you know her last name later when you let us know Ty's partner, but she has a very interesting job. She's not a survivor herself, but her husband is a veteran, and she writes a column on resources for veterans, which would include TBI and PTSD survivors in our realm, but on resources, you know, the government has a lot of resources they don't tell the veterans about, so they're never utilized, and she has written a book of resources and is helping veterans try to find these helpful resources, and right now she's writing a column in Stars and Stripes magazine. So I'm excited about the next 4 weeks of guests. So
that's
I'm going to
cool.
spread mine out over 4 weeks instead of putting them all on Monday, Craig.
Well, I don't have a choice. They're all in one place on a Monday, so.
Oh, too bad. I mean, it's nice to be booked out a little bit. It's too bad you have to have
yeah.
them all on one night. But, anyway.
I got 4 weeks scheduled. I don't have next week scheduled, but 4 weeks from now I do. I haven't had time to schedule shows.
I haven't either.
I had
like
either.
Smoke on the water.
I hadn't either until last week. We've been too busy training the earlier platform, and so I haven't had time to do that or learn our new system or anything, but I finally took some time last week and just said, it's too stressful doing this last minute. I've got to reprioritize, and those are some of the things my guest was talking tonight about, the protocol and us biting off, you know, more than we can chew, and some things we can do to mitigate that a little bit. And I thought, you know, I got to take some time for myself because I'm getting too stressed about my own, what I came here for initially. You know, I want to help as much as I can our newcomers, but I also, it's less stress on me if I can have my shows out, not have to be geeking out, you know, 2 days before my show. I'm more relaxed, I guess, about it and feel more comfortable doing the interview. So I'm happy. I'm a happy not camper, Craig, right now. But anyway, we're down to I'm a happy Hilton, Craig, right now.
Yeah, you could probably meet Lori too at the camp. I'm trying to talk her into it.
If you've got a Hilton on the mountain, honey, I'll think about it. But this is funny. We'll talk about this.
It'll be Hilton. It'll say it for you.
Please, thank you. A sign will do. That's great. And we'll fill you guys in later on what we're talking about. But for now, I'm getting a countdown and going to play the outro and thank all the sponsors. So thank you, Craig, for stopping in. Good to hear from you. Glad you had a good day. And Allie, thank you so much for your great questions, and I really appreciate your loyal attendance and all that you contribute to the show. Yeah. And get rested up from that conference. And next week, you know, when I do my show, maybe in the overtime, you can tell us a little bit about the conference. And thank you for being here tonight. And Les Paul, as always, you know, you're my my rock and my partner, and I appreciate you being here tonight too. So thank you. And the rest of you listeners out there and those that support Brain Injury Radio and, of course, me, Recovery Now, appreciate it. God bless all of you. Have a great rest of the week. And I'm going to close the show in the usual way, and that's with something I believe that we all have. And that is a guardian angel. This is Guardian Angel with Leah West. Thank you, TBI Survivor Network, for sponsoring Brain Injury Radio. And thanks again to Lash Publishing for sponsoring Recovery Now. Good night, everybody. And we'll see you next week, I hope. As you grow and make your